to criminalize protests for vandalism, that's also problematic. If vandalism should be treated as vandalism, that must not be treated as an illegal protest. Because for 5,000 to protest and for 5 people to vandalize and for all those people to be treated the same, that's problematic. So those are just some of the issues that we have the problem with. And it's not necessarily up to us to say. I think it's up to you, members of parliament, and there are other organizations that I think might know more in terms of what to propose, what other jurisdictions might have that can be looked at. And so I think the main aim, I think the main presentation is looking at the issue of the minister and the broad sense of the bill in terms of the minister's powers, and also the broad scope of what could be declared as critical infrastructure and when that might be, and who has the powers to do that. Because now it gives the minister and also it gives the person in charge, also the person in charge of a certain infrastructure, certain powers to apply to the minister, and the minister may then declare a certain infrastructure as critical infrastructure.
Thank you very much. Members, any follow-ups? Thank you very much, sir. Is there anything you want to add to your presentation to the portfolio committee? You're welcome. So thank you very much for your participation. If there's anything else you want to add to us in writing, you're also welcome. So thank you very much. We're going to move on, colleagues, to the next presenter, Right to Know campaign. Mr. Mari Hunter and his team. Welcome, Mr. Hunter. I'm just going to allow the members again to introduce themselves, because with every round it's a new presenter. So, Honorable Molobatsi.
Melang bakhaitso, lina la ka tena en tsimo le batsi, ke le loko la committee e, ka le lebo.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Phindile Mola, a member of this portfolio committee. I thank you.
Good morning. My name is Leonard Ramatakani, a member of the committee.
Well, good morning. My name is Philip Mchango, the member of the committee.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. I'm Zakhele Mbele, member of the committee.
And I'm Diane Kola Barnard, also a member. Thank you.
And welcome, Mr. Hunter. You're welcome to continue.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. So, firstly, to the committee, thank you very much for having us, and thank you for starting this process. Unfortunately, it would usually be more than just one person joining you here, but with the revisions in the schedule, it hasn't been possible, so I will do my best to represent the interests of my organization and our views. Just to briefly, I won't go over too much material that the committee has already heard, and I'm not going to go through the entire submission. I'm assuming that I'm just going to draw out bits that I think of particular importance. Briefly, just to outline the Right to Know campaign's interest in the National Key Points Act. We're an organization whose mission and vision statement is spelled out in the submission, but broadly speaking, I think we had grown concerned very early on in the lifetime of the organization with the secrecy that we saw within the National Key Points Act. We did challenge one aspect of that secrecy in the High Court case that resulted in a register of National Key Points being released to the public, and many of our members in different provincial structures are involved in their own community activism at sites where institutions are national key points, and the act actually becomes an obstacle to their work. So that would include the petrochemical refineries in South Durban, and I know that the committee will be hearing from the South Durban Community Environmental Alliance in more detail there. It includes SABC institutions, which are national key points, and where the act has become a challenge to protest against those those studios, and it does include Parliament itself, where the conditions of security and access to Parliament has become an issue for us as well. So broadly speaking, those are some of the reasons that we had become active in calling for the National Key Points Act to be struck. So I think that we want to say that it's not only about the specific clauses that we see in the Act, but I think that the general trend that we saw with how the Act has been implemented, not in its pre-94 life, but its post-94 life, where it's become, where it's continued to have, a presence. Its broad and draconian clauses that we've heard about have resulted in a situation where, for example, officials in both the public sector and in private institutions have used the Act rightfully and wrongfully to invoke secrecy, to prevent access to information. We have examples, for example, of ESCOM power stations, of refineries refusing to provide environmental information and compliance information about themselves simply because they're national key points. Now, whether or not they were right in doing so, whether or not they lawfully did so, is another question. But it did create an aura of secrecy and a lack of accountability, which has become a challenge. And then, obviously, there's the issue of the bans on protest. Now, as you will know, the Key Points Act actually doesn't specifically prohibit protest. Although police have said that there's a regulation that prohibits protest, a police regulation or guideline that prohibits protests within 100 meters of national key points, to this date, we've never actually been able to see this regulation. We've heard about it many times. We've been told about it by individual members. We've never seen it. We're not sure if it's lawful or not. We don't know its status. But we do know that it's a regular situation where police members will drive people away from a key point saying, you're not allowed within 100 meters of this place having a gathering. I think that one of the points we must note is that before 2007, publicly at least, there was no information that we're aware of about the number of national key points. But as you'll see on page 3 of the submission, we've drawn together a register of the growth of national key points over time from 2007 to 2017, where there's been a 66% growth to a total number of about 200. I would also like to just draw the committee's attention to the strategic installations, which the status of which is not clear, but SAPS declares these locations as alongside their national key points. And in fact, that's 255 institutions that have what appear to be national key point-like powers, and it's not clear whether these would be regulated by this bill or not. I think I just want to put it on record that we view this growth of these institutions as a measure of the growth of this policy as a securocratic form of governance that we see in different institutions, and as a whole we see a worrying incursion of this kind of securocratic or state security status policy in our public life. And there are other forms of that trend, and we can discuss them. But unfortunately, we're here just to put on record that we are not satisfied with the bill as a replacement to the national key points, because we see that a lot of the problems that I've just outlined may be replicated in the current bill. We have a 7-point test, which I've also spelled out in the submission, about whether or not a guideline for what we think such a policy should meet before we would say it's something that we can support. And the first is whether or not there's transparency about which sites would be declared as a key point or as a critical infrastructure. The second is whether there are protections to ensure that any secrecy powers within the Act are very tightly limited to core national security issues and no more. The third is whether or not the Act provides protection for whistleblowers, for journalists, for activists, for researchers who may need to expose information about national key points for legitimate public interest reasons. The fourth is whether or not photos and videos of these locations will be prohibited. The fifth is if there are protections to ensure that the bill promotes and supports the right to protest against those institutions that are protected. The sixth is whether or not the scope is narrowly defined to ensure that there isn't this securocratic creep. And the seventh is whether or not there are clear checks and balances to ensure strong oversight and to ensure that anybody who's given powers under the Act is publicly accountable. It's our analysis that the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill doesn't meet those principles, or certainly the majority of them it doesn't meet. And we do see that there are serious concerns about how the bill may violate freedom of expression, access to information, and freedom of assembly. The one that I do want to note that it does appear to meet is question one about the transparency of sites that are protected under the critical infrastructure, but there are some concerns there as well. I want to first, Chairperson, just draw attention to an issue of scope, the scope of the bill, which sites will be protected as critical infrastructure, and highlight that the provisions of the bill suggest, in fact, that there will be a much wider scope than the National Key Points Act. And the reason for that is that there is the inclusion of new factors which fall inside the bill, or fall outside of traditional national security considerations. And this includes the provision of basic services as being a security consideration, the functioning of the economy, the public interest with regard to safety and the maintenance of law and order. These sound very nice, but actually they do represent an expansion of the bill's scope. And these are very many open-ended considerations. When you read these all together, and I've spelled out the clauses that do that, the criteria for critical infrastructure is much broader. And I think that we could see a situation, if this bill became law and were implemented according to its own clauses, we could see very many municipal buildings, potentially every government building at every level of government, many private institutions such as financial institutions, universities, school campuses, mines, refineries, heavy industry, these could all be included under the scope of the bill. And I think you would see a situation where the number of national key points or critical infrastructure would grow from 200 potentially into the thousands, potentially into the tens of thousands. So this is an area of concern, and I would urge the committee to apply its mind to ensuring that if this bill is passed, the scope is dramatically reduced. The second point, I just want to just raise in brief a few concerns around transparency. I had said that the fact that there would be a public register is obviously something that we welcome, but we would say that there needs to be a principle of proactive disclosure, which means not simply announcing in the Gazette once a site has been declared or deregistered as critical infrastructure, but there should be a public register that is readily available, made available in reports to Parliament, but also maintained on a regular basis, for example, on SATS's website. We would put it to the committee that this is actually something that could be implemented now within the National Key Points Act. We know that there's no longer any justification for the secrecy around which sites are national key points or not, and so it's something potentially for the committee to consider whether or not that information could be provided to the committee by SAPS and made available to the public already. Just on the question of whether or not these reports to Parliament will be publicly available, the bill does provide, obviously, for the Minister to make reports to Parliament about which sites are protected by the Critical Infrastructures Bill. We would just want some clarity on whether or not that would be to the National Assembly, whether or not that report will be public. Our one concern potentially would be that it would go to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, which would prevent it from being public. And if there was a reporting function, we would just want to clarify whether or not it would be the Committee of Police, which would be preferable. But, Chairperson, I think that the meat of our concerns comes down to the offences. And we can talk about this, many other bits and pieces that we would like to talk about if time allowed, but Section 26 is where the real problems occur in this bill. These offences, and I won't read them out because the committee has them, they potentially criminalize legitimate acts of disclosure. They potentially criminalize the work of whistleblowers, of journalists, of community activists, of researchers, and also to criminalize the acts of protest and dissent. And the Social Justice Coalition submission is very much in line with ours as well, or maybe vice versa. These clauses offer many of the same problems we had with the 1980 Act, but unfortunately they actually go further and offer some new problems as well. So briefly, Chair, just before I go into, can I just check how I am on time? Thank you, sir. So it's our position, as we've put forward in Parliament's work on the Protection of State Information Act, or is it still a bill? Our position is that there should be no secrecy law that can gag the work of a journalist or an activist or a whistleblower who's bringing to light information that is legitimately in the public interest. We have in Section 26 a secrecy provision which could potentially do that. We would want to see a law that robustly protects those sorts of disclosures. Now, there are exemptions in the secrecy clause, and we can discuss those, but our concern is that they are not enough. So this comes down to secrecy about security measures. Section 26.2c places an almost total veil of secrecy about any information related to the safety and security measures of a critical infrastructure. So for example, this would mean, there's two problems here. The first is that this would be a secrecy provision on many security features which are actually visible, that are publicly available. So for example, and I'm sorry that I was late to this committee meeting along with my colleagues, but it's become very difficult to get into a national key point these days. The turnstiles at the entrance to Parliament, the metal detectors, X-ray machines, these are security measures at what an institution that could be a critical infrastructure. We're talking about the fences at ESCOM. We're talking about the guard houses at South Durban petrochemical refineries. These are things that are visible to the naked eye, but could potentially be a national security secret if this bill is implemented. So there's many things that are neither secret nor sensitive that would be protected by the secrecy clause. The second is a more difficult one, which is that there are security measures which would be, under normal circumstances, legitimately sensitive. And yet, if they are protected by a secrecy clause, there needs to be a public interest protection, because there are situations where a journalist or a whistleblower may need to expose legitimately sensitive information because there is a greater value in the public interest of that information being disclosed, and that they should be protected robustly by the law. So the two notable examples that I'd like to draw the committee's attention to, the one would be the upgrades at the president's homestead in Kandla, where this was about the security measures at a site that was declared a national key point. The media and various institutions actually revealed a lot of information about those security measures that would be in violation of the Act under normal circumstances. However, information about the security measures, which would normally be sensitive, became vital to the public interest because they potentially exposed an abuse of power and a misuse of public resources. Another notable example, and this one is a bit closer to home, is the security measures in the institution of Parliament, where there is legitimate sensitivity to the security protocols that are put in place in Parliament. But because of a national conversation about the status of Parliament, its openness, and the security measures, the impact of the security measures on the openness of Parliament, we read about these things in newspapers, in the Sunday Times and the City Press, and actually have brought, this was part of a national conversation that was actually very important for us to understand where Parliament was at. And exposure of that information was in the public interest and shouldn't be a criminal offense. So the members will probably will probably want to discuss the exemptions that are in that section. I'm still on section 26.2c. The exemption just in plain language says that disclosing information about critical infrastructure security measures would be allowed if it's done in terms of the Protected Disclosures Act or any other law. I think that's more or less what it says. These exemptions are not sufficient for us. And the first would be the Protected Disclosures Act. This is an important law. It's the whistleblower protection law, but it doesn't protect everyone. The Protected Disclosures Act, to our reading, protects only employees of an institution from making a protected disclosure. It protects them from losing their job, but only if they follow certain administrative hoops in making their disclosure. You go to a line manager, you go to a lawyer, you go to the public protector. Those are the protections in the Protected Disclosures Act. They don't protect people under every circumstance, and they don't protect people who are not employees. So as a worker in Parliament may bring information forward to a journalist, he may be protected from getting his, or he or she may be protected from losing their occupation, losing their job. But it's not clear that the person that they give the information to is protected if they publish it further. So the Protected Disclosures Act isn't satisfying to us. The second is this issue of any other law, which is also in the exemption. To our reading, the main applicable law would be the Promotion of Access to Information Act, which does provide for release of information upon request. There are two separate issues here. The first is that PAIA, the relevant law, has not been widely implemented, and there's very low compliance with PAIA. So we find about 60% of the time that there are PAIA requests, they're refused out of hand. So that isn't enough protection already. But the second is that we've seen in the way that whistleblowers and journalists work that there are situations where when proactive disclosure mechanisms like PAIA fail, there needs to be protection for people who need to get that information out anyway, because it does expose something that is legitimately in the public interest. So we're done on secrecy clauses. The second big concern that I want to raise about these offenses is the ban on taking videos and footage and other recordings of critical infrastructure. So there are two provisions there that the committee will have seen. The question is, can you take a video or photograph of security measures at financial people? And when security measures include many features of public spaces, the airport, the SABC, the entrance of parliament, this prohibition is a big concern. And in fact, being stopped from taking photographs at national key points is one of the main abuses I think that most people experience when it comes to the implementation of the Apartheid Era Act. In fact, there are no specific prohibitions in the Apartheid Era Act on taking photographs of those locations. It's been, what we say in our submission is that has always been a fantasy that has been invented by officials on the ground. But if this bill were passed, it would become a reality, it would become law. There are two problems there. The first is Section 26.2d, which says that such photographs or films would be prohibited if it's with the intention of, I can't remember the exact wording, sorry, but essentially if it's with the intent of being used for an unlawful purpose, the video footage that is. But this creates a situation where an official on the ground must see someone taking video footage of a public space and make a determination for their own selves about whether or not that footage could be used for an unlawful purpose. It creates a circumstance where any security guard or official at a Gautrain station, at the Reserve Bank, at the SABC, can shut down a recording at that moment because of their concern that it may be used for an unlawful purpose. Without being too rude, it's essentially a nonsense clause. In Section 26.2e, which is the second provision, it effectively empowers the staff member in charge of security at a critical infrastructure to simply place a notice at the entrance or somewhere on site that lays down regulations of whether or not you can take photographs. So it empowers the one person who's in charge of security at a critical infrastructure to make a determination about whether or not photographs and videos would be allowed there. And once again, we ought to, perhaps if we're talking about Kubob nuclear station, if we're talking about a military base, this is one thing. But if we're talking about very many institutions, which, as going back to my question about scope, we could be talking about thousands of public institutions here, libraries, municipal buildings. It allows the security manager effectively to ban photographs of those locations. And that simply isn't acceptable. I want to just talk about some of the options that the committee may have about reforming these. And this is in section 4.1.3 of the requirements, of our submission. The first option the committee has is simply to get rid of these offenses. And I know that's going to be a proposal that might get some follow-up questions. But it is an option to simply get rid of these offenses and genuinely question what value they're serving. But if these offenses were to be kept, the first is to spell out intention. The law has to take account what the intention of the person was who committed an offense when they committed an offense. So was it negligence or was it intentional malice? So currently it says that the action must simply be unlawful, but we would want to see that any such provision must be unlawful and intentional to actually do harm. When it comes to the secrecy provisions, we would want to see a public domain defense or public domain protection. When information is already in the public domain, surely there can't be a secrecy provision there. So, for example, it is now very well known what the security provisions are at the president's private homestead, for better or for worse. Surely circulating that information further couldn't be an offense. Or if information is already in the public domain because it is publicly visible, the turnstiles at Parliament, which is accessible to the public, surely that information isn't legitimately protected by secrecy. The next issue is this question of a harms test, where any offense should be based on the harm that is done, not the act that is criminalized, but it's the damage that is done as the result of an act. So if you expose information but it doesn't have a demonstrable damage to national security, surely that shouldn't be an offense. And finally, and most importantly, this issue of a public interest defense. And I would perhaps as a consideration for the committee to look at the discussions around the Protection of State Information Bill, where this question of including a public interest defense became a question that seized the committee for up to 2 years, where the interest in disclosure outweighs the harm that is contemplated by a disclosure, surely there should be no offense. And finally, we just believe that the prohibition on filming and videoing, these should be scrapped entirely. Chairperson, I won't go into great deal of detail on the issue of criminalizing protests and strikes. I think we would align ourselves, just in the interest of time, we would align ourselves very closely with the submission made by the Social Justice Coalition. Our views there are spelled out in 4.2. But effectively, these provisions which criminalize the hindering, the obstructing, the disobeying of people in control of a critical infrastructure, damaging, endangering, disrupting a critical infrastructure, these are provisions that could seriously criminalize protest at these locations, including very robust forms of protest. And they could further criminalize strikes at national key points. And the issue of the rights of workers who work at these locations is one that I think hasn't been dealt with sufficiently. We have in the past had engagements with, for instance, employees of AXA, employees at refineries, where their ability to organize as workers is limited by the act itself. And I think that this bill, if it were to become law in its current form, would go further than the act does in terms of limiting the rights of workers and protesters in those locations. I think just to emphasize another point that was made by the SJC is that there are already laws that criminalize many of the things that are... there are many laws that already criminalize acts of disruption, acts of property destruction, things like that which may be of concern to the committee. These things are dealt with in the common law, they're dealt with in the Regulation of Gatherings Act, they're dealt with in the Labor Relations Act. There's a real question about whether this is necessary at all in terms of actually securing legitimate security needs. I think the final point is just the harshness of the penalties. Chair, I think we are a bit baffled about why it was necessary, even in very legitimate, sensitive security matters, why it was necessary to take the provisions of the Apartheid Act, where the maximum penalty for most of these things is a 3-year penalty, to increase that to 10 years, to 20 years, to 30 years. It's not clear where the drafter's motivation for these increases is coming from. One final issue, Chair, and this is something that might also be dealt with by the Justice Committee, is there's a significant overlap between one aspect of this bill and the Cyber Crimes and Cybersecurity Bill, which is that the Cyber Crimes and Cybersecurity Bill creates its own provisions for critical information infrastructure, which protects networks, infrastructure which is necessary for internet and ICT technology. There are situations, if you read these two bills together, where a site may be protected by the critical information, the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill, the bill before us today, the building will be protected by that act. But the server room or the network or, in fact, the entire building may also be protected under the Cybercrimes Bill as critical information infrastructure. And the oversight falls to police in one case and falls to state security in the other case. And there's a lot of overlapping and, in some cases, contradictory questions about responsibilities, mandate, powers, and reporting lines. And I think the question of how to resolve that is a very thorny one. But it does need to be resolved because there's another committee working on parallel legislation which overlaps. Chair, I will conclude by saying we've gone through our 7-point test, which I read out at the beginning. there's one clear place where we do think that the bill more or less meets the requirements, which is around the transparency of the sites that are protected. We have some concerns about the oversight mechanisms, the council and the role of parliament, and whether or not that oversight is strong enough. But in terms of the other five remaining considerations, we're concerned that the bill doesn't meet that test. I want to emphasize that we firstly do recognize the need to protect legitimate, sensitive security at so-called critical infrastructure. We are begging to say goodbye to the National Key Points Act, but as the Right to Know campaign, we're not yet ready to welcome this bill as its cousin or its younger brother. And we fear that it does represent a continuation of that policy rather than a departure. And thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter, for your input. We go to the members. Honourable Klungu.
No, thank you, Chair. Well, thanks very much for your presentation. Yes. I'll be very brief. In your own view, as you touched on, particularly, as I said earlier on, I don't know whether you were in that, when I was actually raising a warning to ourselves as part of lawmakers that, based on our recent experiences of abuse of power, you continuously referred to Nkandla. When I know it came to my mind when generals from police, the army, including the medics of the defense, or National Defense Force, they were there to just defend one element only, so-called fire pool. In your own submission, would you suggest that fire pool that Advocate Tulima Tosela rebuked not to be a fire pool, but to be a swimming pool, would you suggest that she would be arrested if and only if this bill in its current form was passed to this 20-year? Just a mere sighting of total abuse of power to achieve narrow, selfish interests. I'm just raising that in your own context. But again, you are raising also the question of taking of photographs or video footage. You see, if I'm inside Parliament, if I bring my kids to Parliament, the times I drive with them to Parliament, they just walk by the statue of President Mandela to take a photo with him there, then would it be declared as unlawful if they do that? But would you also, noting that underneath Parliament you will have various exit points in the event of emergency by officials of government, would you actually then say it will be improper for those high sensitive areas of exit under actually extreme emergency to be taken a video footage of them or photographed, just as a mere separation of that, so that when we are actually then crafting this into law, we can then be able to separate what from less sensitive to the high sensitive. Then lastly, you were raising the question of based still on broadness that even financial institutions can see them being declared as national key points with what you said, draconian laws and all that. Now, if it is like that, noting how many banks, I don't know how many branches of banks, would you expect them to be manned even by police or army or all these institutions, these branches throughout the country? which thing then, I don't know what is it, what can one call that thing? So, is that what you have as a view? Thank you.
Honourable Ramadakane, then Honourable Mulabatsi, and Honourable Kalabana. Thank you, members. Then Honourable, yes.
No, thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Some of the question I just add on what Honourable Mkhlongo was asking. For an example, in your submission 412, you talk about the banning of videos, cameras, photos, and stuff like that. I just want to ask you, I'm sure you have done a lot of research for you to make this submission. You have drawn some experience from various other places. But what I find lacking here is that you don't tell us which, in your research, or for an example, restricting pictures in various places. You don't give us an authority to say, I have been to this country, you have allowed, you can take pictures as you like and post them on the social media as you like. They don't worry. You haven't told us which country does that. And I mean, if you look at, if you just make maybe example, everybody when looks at the White House, you only see wherever you stand, from whatever position, you see one side of it. One side of the building. You don't see everything. Now, would you think that that is draconian? Or would you think that is the interest, they are looking at their own interest in a sensitive area that they do not necessarily they think is important? Do you think that there is an important lawmaking is about balancing of interest? And therefore, do you think that it is correct to balance the interest, because as a journalist, we'll have a particular interest? And their interest may not necessarily be the societal interest, because they're working for a boss and they want to drive a particular issue, and that's what it goes. So would you think that it's important that all this interest and the regulation is one process of managing and balancing those particular interests in the interest of the whole, the interest of everyone? And what's your view? Because although you say you don't necessarily object, but at some emphasis it suggests that you think there is no need at all to have the legislation that protect key points in the country. In your view, I just want to have that view more crystallized, because it sounds to me, as you were presenting at some point, that you have an objection to it. And so there's nothing must happen. We must just, the country must just be open as possible, that everybody can see whatever they want to see. I felt that you were talking about, and I thought that there is an act that already deals with the disclosure, public disclosure, whistleblower protection of that. And so on. It's quite broad, actually. It's not only dealing with official of the state. It covers people that has information. But you have dealt with that, because I was worried that you are missing that point. Aren't you overstretching your emphasis on the thousands and thousands of assumption? Your assumption here is that this act is going to allow thousands and thousands and thousands of buildings and places to be declared key points. What is it based on? Because I don't see any basis for it. What is just maybe hypothetical emphasis, or just making that point? or do you have any concrete evidence to that? Because I think we need to be more specific. I'll come back, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mulabatsi, then Honourable Kalabana, then Honourable Mamula. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. If you remove the offences altogether as per your request, what can replace them? My next one is on the risk categories, where you say the high, medium and low do not shape the security. What do you have in mind to address this? Thanks, Chair.
Mulabatsi, Honorable Karabona, you will be the last one, I think. Oh, Honorable
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. This very in-depth study that you've done. And it's enormously helpful to be reminded by yourselves, as this committee has been over the years, about what I consider to be authoritarian creep. It inches in slowly but surely as each legislation is passed. There's another step in that direction, and it's very worrying. You're highlighting the overlapping between the cybercrime legislation and this legislation. It is, of course, of significant concern, and this committee actually needs to now sit down with both legislation. That, unfortunately, doesn't come to this committee. So you have one committee working in a silo over there on that legislation, and this committee working in a silo over here, and there's been, as far as I know, zero consultation. So that's somewhere we're going to have to start from scratch with that, because you can't have, obviously, legislation passed that details issues over here that contradict issues that are detailed over there. So thank you for highlighting that. And yes, we are seeing and have seen over the years increasing numbers of buildings and entities declared no-go areas in a democracy. I mean, this is something we've all worked very hard to move away from, and now it seems we're heading back in that direction. We have to take decisions on the efficacy of such legislation in a democracy today. Do we want to be like a country? I was being regaled by a journalist yesterday who had a colleague as a tourist, and I think she said in Uganda, took a picture of a police station and found herself locked up behind bars. It was a pretty police station with lovely flowers and things, and she didn't know. But in that country, even that will have you locked up. I agree. It's authoritarian creep. We have to watch against it very, very, very carefully, and that's your job. Frankly, and to hold up the mirror in our faces, and we can't allow that creep to inch its way into every corner of our democracy, because then we're looking a police state in the face. So thank you for highlighting those issues. I think that final one was really brought it home to me, that we have a great deal more work to do on this legislation before we can even think of considering it to be finalized. Thank you.
Honourable Mula.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for your presentation. You said you are not satisfied with the bill. So if you are not satisfied, what is it that needs to be done or included in the bill that will satisfy you? My second question, you talk about Section 26.2D. You said it is a nonsense clause. Why do you say that? And do you have something that can change that? Thank you, Chairperson.
Bele.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to Mr. Hunter for the presentation. My question is, it's a very specific and pointed one about the objection outlined on page 10 and 11 of the right to no submission. The objection to the secrecy about security measures. And it's an objection I've been trying to kind of process and look at it from different angles as the discussion was going on. I'm still feeling a little ambivalence about that objection, because the main question I have in my mind is on what possible grounds could there be for a legitimate disclosure, or let me say a agreeable disclosure of legitimate security measures at critical infrastructure. It's one thing in terms of the broad disclosure issue to say that certainly the list of all critical infrastructure declared should be made public, and that's provided for in reporting to parliaments and so on. In particular, looking at the example that's made about Nganda, is that the key point prior to that is that, the key point is that the public protector's investigation and reports had made the determination that those were not security measures, and that's why it amounted to wasteful expenditure. So if it is a genuine case of legitimate security measures that are key to the integrity and security of critical infrastructure, I'm struggling to see a scenario where there would be ground for a concern about that being kept secret or confidential. I think that's the real question I have. If maybe he can explain us again or come at it from a different angle, that would put my mind at rest. And then I'm also unclear about, on page 11, there's the sentence that says, it's unclear how the blanket secrecy on all security measures in section 26, subsection 2, and that's the issue about disclosure on those security measures, gels with the provision of section 20, subsection 6, which is about the minister having the discretion to restrict the publication of information about the security measures. I mean, that's really the point in which I anchor my evaluation of this discussion, is that when it comes to legitimate security measures in critical infrastructure, assuming that there's been an objective and rational evaluation process leading up to its declaration, I'm struggling to foresee a scenario where that needs to be publicly disclosed. I mean, I can't see how there needs to be public knowledge around how, for example, as the chairperson said, Kuberg has certain security measures, because that's the kind of information you don't want landing up in the wrong hands. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, members. Mr. Ante, if you can go to the responses, thank you.
Thank you very much for making me do my work. These are good questions. Chair, I'm going to try onto them in order, and maybe they're going to start blending into each other. The question about from Honourable Mfongu about let's say about revealing the existence of a fire pool, which may or may not be a legitimate security measure. I won't go into whether or not it's a legitimate security measure, although not very good water conservation. The question of whether or not revealing that would be an arrestable defense. I'm not sure about what the situation would be for a public protector, but for a member of the public to reveal that, it is very possible that they may be able to defend themselves in court to say this was not legitimately sensitive,
or it was not a legitimate security measure, and therefore I shouldn't be prosecuted. And if it doesn't happen at the High Court, it may happen at the Constitutional Court, to say that a blanket secrecy around any security measure, or I think it is any matters relating to security measures, would not be permissible and actually would violate that person's freedom of expression. So it's very likely that they may be able to defend themselves in court at some stage. But what we're doing is creating a huge chilling effect where to go to court to defend yourself against a criminal offense, is, in fact, my brother who I'm following has just done, is a situation that is too high a burden to ask people to carry. Because it's a life-changing moment where you're asked to put your freedom in your own hands to reveal wrongdoing, to say that if you can get a lawyer, if you can afford access to the courts, if you can get a pro bono lawyer, if you can afford to go to the Constitutional Court and take that risk, you may be defended. And that, you know, I think that's not a risk that we want people to have to consider taking. It does create a chilling effect on whistleblowers. I think this follows on your second question, is very similar to this question, which is about where we draw the line between what is legitimately protected information and what information would potentially, let's talk about photographs, whether or not you should be able to take a photograph of everything you see at Kuburg Nuclear Station is an important one. I think that what we've identified within this bill is that it draws no distinction between things which are legitimately sensitive and things which are protected but are not sensitive. So, for example, the statue of Madiba or the tambos in Parliament's courtyard, this is something that, this is a location that the security manager of the critical infrastructure could put up a notice to say there will be no photos at this institution by order of management in terms of the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act. He can make that call. It's highly unlikely it would happen at court, at Parliament, but it is very likely that it will happen at one of these institutions. Maybe it will be a university. Maybe it will be the SAPC. Maybe it will be a refinery, where the security manager is put in the position where he can make a declaration that bans all photographs there, whether or not it is legitimate, whether or not it is protecting sensitive information. And it's not clear in terms of the Act what recourse we would have against such an overstep. We know that at every institution that requires advanced security, that there will be some measures which are overt, your turnstiles, your metal detectors, your security cameras, and there are some measures which might be covert, your escape tunnels, your control room, whatever. This, and I think there's a very reasonable case to be made to say the escape tunnels and the conditions in the control room could be protected. Maybe there shouldn't be photographs in that room. Maybe the existence of those escape tunnels should be secret, except to those people who actually need to know. The point is that this act or this bill doesn't draw a distinction between the turnstiles that I passed through today and the secret tunnels that you're talking about underneath Parliament. And so until the bill can draw a distinction between those things, it's creating a completely unreasonable restriction on freedom of expression and on transparency. And in fact, I'm going to use that word again. It creates a nonsense of the need for security, because the whole point about security is that you protect what is precious and you allocate your resources and your attention there. And the things that are not sensitive, that are not precious, there should be no need to protect them. Follow up, maybe on your point about the White House. I think we shouldn't be guided by whatever madness is happening at the White House. I haven't been able to do a full country by country comparison. In terms of our constitution, we believe that there's no justification for saying that a person in a public space should not be able to take a photograph of the things that they see there. So, in the case, for example, of a White House scenario, I'm not sure why you don't see photographs of the back of the White House. It's highly likely it's because people don't have access to that. So there's access control, which is a legitimate security measure in some instances. But to say that in a public place you're not going to be able to take a photograph of that I think it would be a very questionable provision, and also a very difficult one to enforce. So once again, we protect what a legitimate sensitive security measure whatever is behind closed doors, whatever is under lock and key, those are the things that are protected, but we shouldn't be putting secrecy provisions on things that are open and easy to access. The question of the Protective Disclosures Act, I think we should reemphasize this, and maybe it will be necessary to take a second look at it, that the Protective Disclosures Act, to our reading, protects employees only, not only employees of government, but also employees of a private institution. And now with the amendment, I understand it protects contractors as well. But my reading of those provisions, they say if you make a disclosure about wrongdoing in your workplace, if you follow the right procedures, you should be protected from losing your job or getting transferred to or demoted or getting harassed and all these other things. It was never meant to be a protection for national security whistleblowers, to say that if you have something that is legitimately sensitive that you need to bring out into the public for legitimate public interest reasons, you should be protected from prosecution, your lawyer should be protected from prosecution, the journalist you hand the document to should be protected, their publisher, etc. It was never designed for those circumstances. This is another reason why, again, in the Protection of State Information Bill, that became a key point of discussion, to say that simply putting the Protective Disclosures Act in there as a protection isn't enough, because it's meant to be a labor relations matter. It's not a national security matter. And in fact, even though we have some concerns with the POSID, the secrecy exemptions there were actually expanded far beyond what we see in this bill. But we would want you to go further. So, Chair, the next question was about where this idea of thousands of national key points or critical infrastructure comes from. Of course, we wanted to get your attention on that one. But I think that the idea that it could be well over 1,000 institutions is not madness. And the reason for that, if you will just allow me to pull up the relevant clauses. This is in 16 and 17 of the Act, where it spells out the scope of the bill. It includes provision of basic services as being a necessary, as being one of the conditions in which a site could be declared critical infrastructure. So we looked at where basic services are provided, and that's happening at a national level, it's happening at a provincial level, it's happening at a municipal level as well. Water, housing, sanitation, all of these things. Each of these institutions is actually, their operations are critical to ensuring provision of basic services. 250 municipalities, if you assume just one building in each of those municipalities is providing basic services, which is a very conservative estimate, you're already at 250. You add it to the 200 national key points, you're at 450. Maybe we start looking at private sector institutions. It adds up and it adds up. We know that there's well over 1,000 organs of state, Chair, and if even a few of them have fall within these parameters, I'm very confident that you would see more than 1,000 institutions that are legitimately classifiable as protection, as critical infrastructure, if these provisions are implemented. Maybe if I didn't answer that one, you can come back. Honourable Member, you asked about removing the offences. Why would we want to remove the offences? Now, that was a provocative proposal, but I do want to take a second look at what the intentions of this bill are. I think if we all assume that it is necessary to protect certain sites as being critical, quite simply, the Act, the Apartheid Act, and the bill are putting responsibilities on the owners of sites. Oh, sorry.
Just a moment, Honourable Mulubatsi.
Yeah, my question was not on the why. It was on how do you replace it.
I'm with you. Thank you, Member. The bill puts a responsibility on, if the bill is saying it is necessary for institutions whose operations are critical to safety and security to have a certain level of security, it puts a legal responsibility on the owners of those institutions to meet a standard of security that is required by the state. Now, that is already a measure that puts in place a certain amount of safety and security. We've already identified that there are lots of laws that would criminalize anyone who wants to do anything bad to a critical infrastructure. for example, if it's a terrorism act, if someone is trying to conduct sabotage, that is already a crime. If someone is conducting property destruction, that is a crime. If someone is trespassing, that is a crime. For us, we understand much better the need for these institutions that are sensitive to, you know, that are important to the functioning of the Republic. We understand why there's a need for them to have security measures in place and for them to meet security measures that are spelled out by the police. It's less clear to us why we need new offenses that would further criminalize anyone who interacts with those institutions. Surely if they comply with the security measures in place and are already criminalized for active sabotage, etc., there is a question about whether these offenses are superfluous. I think the second question was about risk categories, high, medium, and low. I think, once again, going back to a point I made earlier, we see that the bill doesn't put in place this idea of being proportional. So, as far as the bill is concerned, every security measure, whether sensitive or not, is protected at the same level. The turnstiles and the secret tunnels have the same protections, even though one of them is very sensitive and one of them isn't. In the same way, we see that the bill has gone towards proportionality by saying there are high risk, medium risk, low risk infrastructure. But once that determination is made, there seems to be no attempt to say, if these are low risk institutions, do they deserve less protection? Are they less, you know, so for example, is the public library having less need for security and less need for these severe penalties than Kubok nuclear station? The act or the bill is not creating these levels in a meaningful way. So that was our concern. I'm going to go next to the question the honourable member raised about what needs to be done. I'm hoping that some of those proposals are spelled out in the submission, but particularly when it comes to Section 26.2d and c, the issues of photographing. Our proposal is actually to remove those provisions entirely, because it's not clear why there would be a legitimate ban on taking photographs and videos of public locations where those matters aren't sensitive. As I said, where there are legitimately sensitive security measures in place, they shouldn't be available to the public in the first place. So that's why we've made that proposal. And we would be happy to make follow-up proposals to the committee if it was necessary to spell out some other proposals that we might have. I think this takes me to the... I'm wrapping up, Chair, and thank you for your patience. The last question is around the secrecy provisions and whether or not it is legitimate to say that there must be public interest protections to any disclosures. Firstly, we haven't gone into detail in our submission, and if it were valuable, we would be very happy to put together a more detailed memorandum or submission on this particular question, because a lot of work was done some years ago around the Protection of State Information Bill around the same questions, and a lot of very creative proposals and solutions came out of that from different members and different stakeholders. But there are a few... I think the first thing to point out is that putting in place a public interest defense actually provides very limited protection for someone, because what it says is that if you expose the information and it turns out that your disclosure, let's say you're a journalist and you get information that you believe is legitimately in the public interest, if you bring it to the public and it turns out that actually your disclosure was very trivial, it wasn't relevant to the public interest, but it did compromise or prejudice national security, you face a very big legal problem and probably will pay a high price for it. The putting in place of a public interest defense surely provides the narrow protections that are necessary in whatever circumstances arise, and we can speculate what they might be, where disclosing something that is under normal circumstances sensitive is justified because the disclosure, the interest in the disclosure outweighs any potential harm done. So when you talk about legitimate security measures and whether or not those can be disclosed, the first thing to mention is that there may be situations where the security measures need to be disclosed because they're not legitimate. So for example, if we were to discover and I'm not saying this is true, that in the precinct of parliament, the security staff are on a shoot-to-kill orders, where we would say this is, you know, this is obviously going to be a matter of great concern to the members, the public, to everyone else. Disclosure of that information would be necessary potentially to rolling back the decision and to opening the decision to public debate. There may be instances where the security measures are not the thing that is actually what is at stake. So, for example, if we discover that the security staff, the sensitive security staff in Parliament, are working 24-hour or 48-hour shifts, where in fact the security measures are not sufficient, you know, there's big problems there. That would be an instance where disclosing information about the security measures, which would be ordinarily protected under this Act, might be warranted in order to actually protect the legitimate security of the institution. So those are some of the examples that we could speculate on. I think that it is really necessary to emphasize that when we talk about a public interest defense, we're not talking about a free-for-all. We're actually talking about putting in a safety mechanism that will possibly never be used. But if it is ever exercised, it will be only on the most sensitive matters. And I think it's the way the honourable member talked about the need to find a balancing act. Putting in place that security, that safety mechanism, is a way of ensuring that there is that balance between the need to protect legitimate security and the need to protect the greater interests of the public as well. Chair, thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much, members. We want to move on to the next presenter, but if there is any other follow-ups or any matter, Honourable Mbele.
Thanks, Chair. Just a quick follow-up for clarity to make sure that I understood the response correctly and therefore captured it correctly in my notes for use later in committee deliberations. So it sounds to me like the objection to that section really comes down to the fact that it doesn't differentiate between sensitive and non-sensitive security measures and the fact that the absence of a public interest defence in relation to that disclosure. If it's covered in those two aspects, then it would be okay. Yeah.
Kani, did you also have a follow up, or you've covered?
No. I think, Chair, the presenter did come back to the. I thought he forgot to deal with the balancing of interest and the regulations and importance of it. But I think in the closing here, he will attempt to agree with me of the importance of that. So I will leave that there.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hunter, if you can just respond to those two things and anything else you want to put to the committee, you're welcome. Thank you. Yes, Honourable Bailey.
Sorry, Chair, it's a slightly trivial point, so I'm sorry if it's a distraction, but just to point out that there are plenty of photos available online of the White House from the front and the back, from far and from near. So if in case that ever becomes a hinge for a discussion later, it's not really relevant.
Fake photos or fake news. Right, Mr. Hunter?
We will engage with Honourable Bella around it, but I think that... The point is made that I think the presenter did respond to that question, that for some sensitive and security reason, and I think he did say so, although he started on the lighter note about the madness of America, I thought it was a joke, so leave it there.
Members, Mr. Hunter, you're welcome.
Just in brief, I think the two key points, excuse me, the two important matters that I would like to weigh on is firstly to you, sir, that we would perhaps agree that there's a need to balance these two things. Where the disagreement usually occurs is where that balance is appropriate. But I do believe that an inclusion of a public interest defense is where that balance can be appropriately struck, where it asks essentially the court to apply its mind about whether the public interest has been served by a disclosure, and therefore whether or not the whistleblower or the journalist is protected in their freedom of expression when they make a disclosure. And just to the Honourable Mbele's point, I think it would maybe we would be very happy to provide further submissions on and potentially more detailed submissions on this question of finding the appropriate balance of the public interest defence, and if that would be useful to the committee, we'd be happy to come back on that. And I'm covered otherwise. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hunter, for your participation. And thank you, members, for the questions. If there's also anything additional you want to bring to the attention of the committee in writing, you're welcome to do so in the next week. We'll appreciate that. Members, to use a cricket terminology, we're about 5 minutes to tea on the second day. But I think we will continue until the tea arrives. We're a bit behind, but just bear with us. Let's get the South Durban Community Environmental Affairs to do their presentation. Thank you.
No, I don't.
Have they arrived? They're not here yet. So let's move on then to the next presenter, the South African Catholic Bishops Conference, the Parliamentary Liaison Office, Advocate Mike Pontier, and you're welcome.
And so I normally keep these cards that you can get from the
Yes.
And then I can just highlight that you should see.
Okay.
Much, honourable members, advocate, you're very much welcome. You can continue.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, honourable members. Pleasure to appear before you once again. One or two people may be asking themselves why the Catholic Church takes an interest in a matter like this, simply because it has an impact on important human rights. So you've heard much about that already, obviously, people's freedom of movement and of assembly and of access to information, etc., etc., human rights being obviously indivisible. If one set of rights is negatively affected, or for that matter promoted by a piece of legislation, then all our rights are likewise affected or promoted. We made submissions on the draft bill that was circulated during the course of last year, and it is very encouraging to see that quite a number of the submissions made then by ourselves and a number of other organizations were taken up and now appear in the bill that is before you. That's very encouraging to note that. And it once again shows the participatory nature of our legislative process in this country, something that I think we can all be very proud of and grateful for. I'm going to run through our main submissions fairly quickly because I know that you all have copies of the submission, and then I'll be guided by yourselves as to which points, if any, you feel you'd like me to expand upon. Firstly, just to note that the provisions of this act ultimately will not apply to infrastructure under the control of the National Defence Force. We simply want to raise a question around that and ask, what is the intention? Is all Defence Force property already adequately covered in the view of the drafters by the Defence Act or other legislation, or is it the intention to introduce more legislation to deal with defence infrastructure? One member has already referred to creeping authoritarianism. We're well aware of that. I'm not saying that this is happening in the present matter, but one would be a little bit alarmed if the Defence Force, which obviously is in control of an enormous percentage of the critical infrastructure of the country, was going to be treated in some sort of different or special way, perhaps if defence infrastructure was going to have even tighter controls around it. One would want to just raise a little question mark around that. Secondly, the Critical Infrastructure Council. We note what is, in our view, a fairly significant improvement that an official of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development will be a member of the council. The reason for suggesting that in our submission to, on the draft bill was that the council was rather security heavy, and we thought they didn't have the necessary expertise, as it were, from the other side of the debate, the people that deal with rights, that promote rights, that our Department of Constitutional Development. So it's good to see that there'll be at least one official from that side on the council. As for the appointment of the five members, yes, there is a more consultative process, and we welcome that. However, we still question why no active role has been given to Parliament in this regard. We're seeing in a number of different ways at the moment, and perhaps over the last year or two, what strikes us as a kind of reassertion by Parliament of its right of oversight, of its oversight role and duty. If we think of the committee that sat last year around the appointment of the SABC board, the committees that are sitting today looking into the matters of ESCOM and Steinhoff, etc., etc. This is exactly, of course, what members of Parliament and parliamentary committees ought to be doing. We would like to see more of that sort of thing happening. So when it comes to the appointment of a small but crucial council like this one, we want an active role for Parliament there. We want you to be able to interrogate the process whereby these people are chosen, and in fact the people themselves, and to look at their CVs and to judge their backgrounds and so on. Not simply have a list placed before you as is provided for noting. What is the point of asking Parliament simply to note a decision made by the Minister? So a greater role for yourselves, I think, is important there. And of course that gives us then as members of the public and civil society the role, over the possibility of coming to you and making our submissions about who those people should be. The functions of inspectors, again, it has changed somewhat from the draft bill. And our concern here is that if somebody refuses to give an inspector access, the inspector may simply issue a compliance notice which requires that access be given. That makes the inspector, as it were, a sort of judge in his or her own case. The draft bill had a provision to say the inspector in such a situation should approach a magistrate, place evidence before the magistrate, and secure some sort of a warrant or an order allowing access. That seems to be a very reasonable position, and it obviously echoes the normal search warrant procedure. An inspection can be not just an inconvenience, it can be a very serious violation of privacy. It could put a business concern into, I'm looking for a word that's stronger than inconvenience, but into a loss-making situation. It may have to shut down operations, for example, to allow a proper inspection to take place and so on. So it's a weighty matter. And we don't believe that an inspector, simply because he has been refused access, should be able to simply fill out a form and thereby demand access. There must be some sort of an objective procedure, preferably before someone like a magistrate, before such a potential violation of privacy can take place. Around declaration as critical infrastructure. For us, this is perhaps one of the most important of the clauses. What the bill provides for is that the minister must take into account potentially negative consequences like loss and damage and unlawful disruption, etc., etc., if an infrastructure is not declared to be critical and therefore to be given the protections that flow from that. But there seems to be nothing that requires the minister to apply his or her mind to the potential negative consequences for public's rights, the public's rights, the rights you've heard about already, movement, assembly, access to information, etc., etc. And for us, that reflects a certain lack of balance. Because we can all imagine a situation where the minister or any official for that matter could look at a potential critical infrastructure, piece of property, a building or whatever, and say, yes, indeed, you know, if I don't give this some protection by declaring it to be critical, various negative consequences could flow. But what about the consequences that would flow as a result of the declaration itself? In other words, it's about a proper balance. I've heard already this morning that that concept has been discussed. It must obviously be at the forefront of a matter like this. Anything that limits access is a restriction of a right. It will often be a very justifiable restriction of a right, but not always. And the only way to determine that is to conduct some sort of balancing inquiry. Yes, ultimately a court could do that if a matter was taken to court, but there's no reason why the minister should not do that up front and be required to conduct some sort of a balancing inquiry. So that is the purpose that we have, that is behind our suggestions in page 5 of our submission about an additional sub-clause to go at the end of the existing clause 16.2, where the minister should be required to consider whether the declaration of such infrastructure as critical infrastructure will disproportionately prejudice the rights of members of the public. Disproportionately, in other words, to express the question, the concept of balance here. And a similar provision could be added at the end of clause 17. In effect, it repeats that. This is dealing with kind of factors that need to be taken into account. One such factor must be the negative impact of such a declaration. Moving on, clause 20, subclause 2b, gives people no less than 30 days to make representations if their infrastructure is, if they're notified that the infrastructure is going to be declared as critical. We simply suggest that that's just not long enough. These can be very complex matters. It may be that the owner of a potentially critical piece of infrastructure wants to take legal advice, might have to take financial advice, etc., etc. To have all that happening within 30 days seems to us, in some cases, to be a bit unreasonable. Yes, in many instances it might be quite a simple matter, but there seems to be no harm in giving the person concerned a more realistic kind of time frame, whether that's 60 days or 90 days or something like that. But 30 days is just a little bit too tight in our view. Item 5 of our submission deals with the certificate of declaration, and we very much welcome the fact that it is provided that there will be a register containing the details of critical infrastructure and that this will be available to the public. This is obviously one of the central failures of the National Key Points Act, which rendered it certainly unconstitutional, and it was not clear from the draft bill that there would be such transparency about what is and is not critical infrastructure. So that's of key importance, and we are very happy to find that it is provided for. Item 6 of our submission deals with the duties of persons in control. Really, the point that we want to make here is that it seems unfair that the private owner of a piece of infrastructure, which is then declared to be critical by a public body, should be made to pay the associated costs of securing it or whatever. The private owner is not in a position to say, well, actually, thank you very much, but I'd prefer it if you didn't declare it to be critical. Ultimately, the minister can take that decision and make the declaration. And that's a public purpose. And quite simply, public purposes should be paid for by the public purse. I don't think that it is justifiable to require private owners to pay for public purposes. Now again, you might sit and think, well, big corporations can afford it, and probably most of them can. But there's nothing in this that says that only big corporations or wealthy people are the owners or controllers of critical infrastructure. It could be a small business. It could be someone who's put out of business by the associated security expenses. So quite simply, make the public liable to pay for the public purpose of declaring something critical infrastructure. Another very important point in our view is in item 7 of our submission. We believe that the provisions around access to critical infrastructure are far too wide and that they amount to blanket prohibitions which are unnecessary and unduly invasive of the rights to freedom of movement, assembly, expression, protest, and so on. I know that this point has already been dealt with in some of the other submissions, but I'd like to just draw your attention to the definition of basic public services in Section 1, Clause 1 of the Bill. Basic public services include a service provided by the public or private sector relating to, and those are crucial words, communication, energy, health, sanitation, transport, and water. Now, relating to is an extremely wide or broad phrase. I've suggested that something like a pharmacy or a taxi rank would be a basic public service. One relates to health, one relates to transport. Every railway station in the country relates to transport. And as for the debate about how many such pieces of critical infrastructure there might be, every railway station could be declared one. And there's well over 1,000 railway stations in the country. So something needs to be done to Clause 25 to distinguish between items of infrastructure which we would all agree must have access control and strict access control. I heard Kuberg being mentioned earlier this morning. That's obviously one of them. Nobody is suggesting for a minute that the public should be able to walk into the president's office in the union buildings. But nobody wants a situation where some official, even acting in good faith, some station master declares his little railway station to be critical infrastructure and no one's allowed to take a picture of it or come onto the platform without his written permission or whatever, or whatever, whatever. Or a church. I'm not sure the churches are critical infrastructure. But I think we can see that Clause 25 in that sense is simply far too widely framed. We need to have some sort of mechanism to distinguish and thereby limit access where it really needs to be limited, but not interfere with access and movement and people's general rights, even to take pictures, when it is simply not required at all. So Clause 25 is too blunt. It needs to be refined. The matter of the offences and penalties has also been raised by some of the other submissions, and we join with them in asking why it has been seen fit to prescribe penalties in some cases 6 times heavier than the penalties prescribed in the apartheid era for similar offences. That just simply makes no sense whatsoever. And yes, the argument can be made, these are maximums, and courts don't have to impose the maximum penalty. But we know that when a court is told you can go up to 30 years on this, it's unlikely to give 6 months. If it's told you can go up to 3 years on this, it might consider giving 6 months. So that's the provision for very high maximum penalties has a kind of upward effect on sentences that are ultimately imposed. Clause 26 criminalizes photographing or filming of critical infrastructure with the intent to use such pictures or film for an unlawful purpose. An unlawful purpose is not defined. It would be very difficult, obviously, to define some sort of closed list of unlawful purposes. But the point is, how is a member of the public supposed to know? I might want to take a picture of Simonstown Naval Base from Red Hill, where there used to be signs at the parking lot prohibiting anyone from taking a picture under the Key Points Act. Or the Defense Act, perhaps, in the old days. And that meant you couldn't take a picture of Simonstown, which is a very beautiful thing to do. Now, I might stand there wanting to take such a picture simply to record my holiday, but I don't know whether that's lawful or not. And if you're a lawyer, you may have an inkling, but if you're not, or if you're a foreign tourist, then what are you to do? So, once again, 26 is just too vaguely phrased, too broadly phrased. And something needs to be done to provide, to prevent a very severely chilling effect here and a kind of self-policing on the part of members of the public, which will end up being, once again, a limitation of their rights. We note around the regulations that when the minister publishes the draft regulations, he must consider, or she must consider, written comment thereon, and we welcome that very strongly. That doesn't always seem to happen in the matter of regulations, and they can be very, very important, so that is a welcome provision. And then lastly, around the transitional arrangements, If, as clause 30 sub 1 provides, existing national key points must be deemed to be critical infrastructure until the final decision is made as to whether or not to declare them as such under the new legislation, then a list must be published. If it isn't, you're once again in a situation where something is going to be deemed critical infrastructure and the public has no way of knowing what is or isn't. That really largely defeats many of the provisions of this bill and drags it back to being almost an echo of the National Key Points Act. It would be hard to see, of course, any prosecution succeeding if a person does something around a national key point while they were unable to know that it was a national key point. But once again, that's after the person has been arrested and charged and ended up in court, and we can't have that situation. So, quite simple, someone somewhere has got a list of the existing national key points, publish it. Chairperson, those are our submissions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Advocate. Honourable members, we will take a 10-minute tea break now, and then we'll come back for questions and interaction with the Advocate. Thank you very much. Members, 10 minutes. Thank you.
Take in as much as I can, sure. Then he starts counting.
Like the appointment of the members of the SABC board, where the portfolio committee will call for nominations. We will interview the candidates, and those names will be referred to the executive board. Just maybe get some thoughts on that from you. Let's go to the other members. Honorable Mulmula.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for your presentation. My question is one. I heard you were talking about the scanners of parliament, that when you enter into parliament, there are scanners and everything. What is it that you need to be done by parliament for not using the scanners? Are you saying people must enter parliament without checking or not? Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Marke.
Thank you, Chairperson. And I would like to thank the advocate. The presentation is well structured. My first question would be on the Balancing Act. Who, according to the advocate, must do the balancing? And how should it be done? Should it be published in the media? Should there be public participation before a place can be declared a critical infrastructure? How do you think that must be done? And I wouldn't have a problem with the extension, whether 60 or 90 days, where it's no problem with that. And my second question would be, in terms of your understanding, in terms of offences and penalties, what would be your suggestion there? Because if I was to say the 20 or the 30 years is simply a ceiling from 0 to 30, depending on this, the unlawfulness or the purpose of whoever did that. And I was checking in the act itself, 24.8, it's talking about demarcating. Wouldn't that, according to your understanding, meaning that in Parliament you can get in, you can take photos from the street, but there will be areas that are demarcated. Wouldn't that cover that concern? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think Honourable Marke has covered me on demarcation of sensitive and less sensitive areas within the precinct and outside of the precinct of such a demarcated area as a national key point area. But I think you spoke about something very important, which I think any first year scholar of law will understand. When we talk of the evolution of law itself, so that the law is not just taken as this big animal that is foreign to the people, but that is part and parcel of a culture of the people. When you spoke about the active role, non-existence of the active role of Parliament, in the crafting of this particular bill, what would be your suggestion so that we can then be able to, when we are then engaging in the discussion, we can further escalate that in order to ensure that there is a total ownership by the people of the whole process in the build-up to the legislation itself. Again, on the question of penalty, you are making a very critical comparison between the apartheid era penalty and the penalty suggested on the bill, which you say, and I agree with you, that is almost 6 times more than the previous, which one would characterize as just a no longer a corrective element, but now something that seeks to destroy even a person. Because if you jail a person for 20 years or more than 25 years, it means you just finish that person instead of correcting the attitude of that particular person. What would be your suggestion in terms of the imposition of penalty, noting that the law or the rules must just correct the behavior of the people instead of destroying them? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mbele. Honourable Kodobana, then Honourable Ramatakane.
Thank you, Chair. Advocate, is it? Yes? I find myself asking more and more whether or not this bill is actually a necessity. I'm now wanting your input. Trespass is already covered, terrorism covered, cybercrime about to be covered. So what we're actually doing here is taking an apartheid era bill created to stop protests, stop photographers, stop anybody doing anything that disagreed with that regime. Now, I'd like your opinion. Should that legislation simply be left to rot on the trash heap of all legislation from that era, or are we obliged to replace it? Is there actually a need to replace the National Key Points Act? I'm most interested to hear your input. The draconian tenets of some of those clauses have actually stopped me in my tracks and forced me to rethink the entire process. Thank you.
Honourable Member, Honourable Ramatakane.
No, thank you very much, Honourable Chair. And advocate, I think the presentation was good. It's well communicated. But I just want to ask your view on the section 2 or critical or the council, when you speak about the council. You have a view which is attractive, but I'm cautiously attractive to it. And that provision is the active role of Parliament. Now, if this is in a structure that hear these matters and make a comment whether this should be or should not be, how are we going to deal with that in the context of the separation of powers? You do have three spheres of state, and Parliament has a distinct role of making a law, and then after that make sure that it's oversight. So if we were to get involved, would it not be encroaching on the other sphere of government? I just want to get a view, because as I say, it's attractive, because we would then be participatory at the level where we make decision whether this must be declared or not declared, and bound by that decision, representing an institution. Will that not limit the institution in one level? And the second level, will it not mean that this institution is a core functioning and court executive, with the executive now? That's the one question I thought maybe I should maybe get some counsel from you. The one other part that that I wanted to ask the question, I also felt that it was a 60 days section under the declaration and certificate. I think that it's reasonably argued to the fact that 30 days may be not reasonable, but I think that's a more for committee to look at. Then I just want to check, advocate, on the six duties and control of infrastructure. Not actually that one. The public purpose. The public purpose. I think I let me leave it. I think I agree with that. That somehow. But now you have a current provision. Current provisions makes a obligatory that once something has been declared and you are an owner, you have to make sure that there's a compliance. So are you suggesting that that approach is inappropriate and therefore it should be scrapped, in line with what you just said, suggesting here? And under 8, and this is not to say I agree with the current penalty schedules. I'm asking the question. You do have a statement, looks like statement of fact, when you say that that assumptions of a high penalty automatically instruct the court to increase the sentence. Now I was just wondering the authority of this. Where's the authority of it, or is it just assumption, or is it looking at in terms of the, I don't know, I don't want to lead you on this, I'm just asking that. So you're saying if it's 3 years, the assumption is that the magistrate might now give you imposed 3 months. So you see correlation between the high and automatic law.
I just want to find out the kind of authority for that, if you may. Let me leave it to Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. Honourable Markey, additional one. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the basic public service, I think the original one was saying essential. If it can go to the original, would that be fine with you, Advocate? And on the personal expenses of, I think I would maybe agree with that. Are you suggesting maybe there must be a means test so that we check whether you can afford? Because even in heritage, it applies that way, that if a building maybe is over 100 years, even if it's yours, you can't do changes or something of that nature. Are you suggesting maybe there be a means test or something? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members, for the questions. Over to Advocate Pontieri. You're welcome.
Thank you, Chairperson. I hope I can do all of that. The question, your question about the appointment of members to the Council and a specific role for the Portfolio Committee or for Parliament in general, and I think my answer may also touch on Honourable Ramatakane's question about separation of powers and so on. I think in general terms we are seeing that in the eyes of the public, when people are appointed to high and important public office, they enjoy a much greater credibility when the appointment process has been open and transparent and participatory and all of those good things. The classic example is the Judicial Service Commission, where anyone can go and watch potential judges being interrogated and various interest groups and political parties and so on can grill them. And when judges ultimately emerge from that process, I think it's generally accepted, they are seen as legitimate, as well qualified, as appropriate, etc. It's been an excellent part of our democracy since under this constitution, the work of the JSC. We saw the same thing happening last year with the SABC board, which a corporation that had been in dire straits had lost almost all of its credibility probably over the previous years. Parliament steps in and says, right, we're going to have public hearings, the media is going to be present, organizations can make submissions, tell us who they want, who they don't want. And the board that emerges at the end of the day, you can argue about whether or not it was perfect, but it was a lot better, and the process was open. We saw it with the selection process that Parliament undertook regarding the new public protector. Once again, you can argue and quibble about whether the right person was selected and how her performance has been and compare her to her predecessor, but the fact is, it was an open process. We could all come along and say our say, and nobody could claim at the end of the day that anything had been done untowardly or under the table or whatever. If we didn't sufficiently interrogate the candidates and nominate other candidates, that's our fault, not Parliament's fault. All I'm saying is that when it comes to something like the Critical Infrastructure Council, which is potentially a very important body, we should try to follow some sort of similar procedure and not simply leave it up to the minister. Yes, there's a provision there for a committee to sit and to ask for nominations and to draw up a short list of 20, and then those people have to be vetted, and then it has to go to cabinet and all the rest of it. But that's all within the executive branch. And there is no provision anywhere there for public involvement, for the likes of ourselves to come along and say, we do not think so-and-so is suitable candidate. That can only happen if there's a parliamentary involvement. Parliament is structured for that kind of public input and for you as representatives of the public to have your say about it as well. I don't believe that it encroaches on the separation of powers. It's not taking powers away from the minister. For me, it's a question of complementing the powers. Parliament has a certain role, the minister has a certain role. The details could be worked out. But, for example, again, with the appointment of judges, the JSC presents the president with a list which is always one or two more than the number of candidates that are needed. The president then carries out his executive prerogative to choose from that list. And that's a system that appears to me to have worked very well. Something similar could happen here. The portfolio committee, for example, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head, could present the minister with 10 names that it is satisfied would be good for the council, and the minister could then choose 5 of those 10. Something like that could happen. And I think, as I say, rather than subtracting from or interfering with the separation of powers, it would be a complementary process, allowing both branches to have their say. Further than that, I can't, off the top of my head, give you an absolute sort of chapter and verse specific role. I think there are enough examples, as I say, that we've seen recently in Parliament that one or other model could be adopted. The hearings for the Human Rights Commission a couple of years ago, beginning of last year, I think also had that kind of public openness and scrutiny that is so important. So one of those models could be adopted for the Critical Infrastructure Council. Second question was around scanners at the entrance to Parliament. I'm afraid something that I said may have been misunderstood. Perhaps I've got no objection of whatsoever to scanners at the entrance to Parliament, and indeed at many other such facilities. We go through scanners at the entrance to the High Court every day and so on. It's obviously a reasonable, perfectly reasonable requirement. The Balancing Act, and who must carry out the Balancing Act? I think we're asking, in effect, that the minister must apply his or her mind to the question of the proportionality. What will be, in other words, the minister can say, yes, I can see why it makes sense to declare this piece of infrastructure as critical. We're simply asking that the minister must also ask that, take that further step and ask the further question, if I do that, what might be the negative consequences, the unintended even negative consequences of it? That's the Balancing Act. Ultimately, a court of law will adjudicate whether the Balancing Act was properly carried out or not, according to well-established principles of review and so on. So if the minister declares something to be critical infrastructure and the owner or a member of the public disagrees with that decision, they're free ultimately to have the minister's decision reviewed, and a court can then, in effect, carry out the Balancing Act. But always better if the public authority does so and correctly applies their mind, takes into account all possible factors in the first instance. If they do that properly, then you avoid the time and wasted effort of court cases and all the rest of it. We can all see that the minister has taken into account both the pros and the cons of such a declaration. Our point is simply that the moment the bill makes provision for the minister to consider the pros, the reasons why it should be declared, does not ask him to take into account the reasons why it should not be declared critical. Should there be public input in that process? I'd like to say yes, but at a practical level I'm not sure, because I do envisage that the authorities out there are going to be approaching the minister, the transport authorities, the health authorities, all those that are mentioned in that definition of basic public services, the security authorities of one kind or another, lots and lots and lots are going to be approaching the minister with applications or suggestions that he should declare this, that, and the next thing to be critical infrastructure. And at a practical level, I'm not sure how you would have public input before each such declaration. What you could have, and perhaps what the committee could give consideration to, and I may have missed it if it's in the bill already, is some sort of opportunity for objections to be lodged to such declarations. You know, rather than having to go through a public participation process before each and every little whatever is declared, make a provision to say, if you're unhappy with the declaration, this is what you can do. You have 60 days or 90 days to lodge an objection or whatever. As I say, I didn't pay attention to that question, so there may be something already in the bill on that. Offences and penalties, I think there were a couple of questions around that. what do we suggest? I'm not going to say we suggest it should be a maximum of 5 for this and maximum of 8 for that or whatever, but 30 years for any person who unlawfully and intentionally tampers with critical infrastructure. Now clearly, no one envisages that a little bit of minor tampering is going to bring down a sentence of 30 years. But if 30 years is the outer limit, and a court is faced with a fairly sort of minor incident, what is the court to do? The chances are that the court is going to say, even subconsciously, you know what, this particular offense could go all the way to 30. So clearly, to give 6 months or a year or a suspended sentence is inappropriate. This is really heavy stuff. It carries a maximum of 30 years. That's more than you get for a murder. Chances are you're going to get courts giving people 10 and 12 and 15 years. That's what I mean by the upward pressure. If the maximum sentence is 5, for the same middling offense, the court is much more likely to say, well, we'll give 2, or we'll give 3, 1 year suspended, or whatever. Honorable Mwathani asked about authority for this proposition that high maximum provisions have an upward pressure on sentences. I think, I'd have to check on this, but I think that in the Malchus case, which was the classic case that dealt with the minimum sentencing legislation, case from 2000, if I recall correctly, that the Supreme Court of Appeal there made reference to this question of the upward pressure. The other case where it might be found is I think the case was in Glovu, where the Constitutional Court pronounced ultimately on the constitutionality of the minimum sentence regime. And there may be reference there. I've come across it once or twice in criminal practice that there are cases that have referred to this upward pressure. It's a psychological pressure on a judicial officer, and it's quite understandable, I think. It's not strange that it should be so. Another thing to take into account, Chairperson, with a sentence of 30 years, is that the courts have recently pronounced against what they call Methuselah sentences in criminal matters. After the introduction of the minimum sentence provisions, and for that matter possibly even before, but certainly after the death penalty moratorium came into place, some of our courts imposed sentences of 30, 40, even 50 years imprisonment for particularly horrific murders and rapes. And when it was finally decided to replace the death penalty with the sentence of life imprisonment, the question arose of what does life mean? And in terms of the Correctional Services Act, as you know, it means you may apply for parole after 25 years. And that led courts again to say, well, hang on, we don't want to sentence this person to life and run the risk that after 25 years he can come out because he really did something absolutely heinous. So we're going to give him 40 years. And that was then thrown out by the Supreme Court of Appeal, which said, no, life is the maximum sentence in our criminal law, and that's it. You cannot seek to get around the provisions of parole by imposing a sentence of 40 or 50 years. Now, how does that square with Parliament trying to make provision for sentences of 30 years? Seems to me there may be a certain contradiction there. Yes, if you get a 30-year sentence, you can apply for parole before 25 years. You can apply after 15 or two-thirds of your sentence, whatever the case may be. But the point I'm driving at is that there seems to be a general move in our law, in our criminal law, against these Methuselah type sentences. And that for me would be another reason for you to revisit these very drastic maximum penalties. It was then the question about section clause 24.8 and the question of demarcation and placing a notice notifying persons that the premises are declared a critical infrastructure. I think, yes, no problem with that. The information must be put out there to enable members of the public to behave in relation to the infrastructure in the way that they ought to if it is critical. But I think what's more important is what are the kinds of things, what are the kinds of acts that we want to stop people from doing? Do we want to stop people from taking photographs of a place because it happens to contain, as the example I used, a naval base? My answer would be, no, we don't. I don't see the need for that. Do we want to stop people taking photographs of, you know, specific piece of weaponry sitting on the deck of a submarine in Simonstown Naval Base, yes, you might very well want to. That might be a very legitimate security restriction, whereas a photograph from a distance of the base as a whole is not the same thing. I don't know exactly how you go about making those distinctions or where you draw the line. Part of the balancing act is always that where do you draw the line thing. But I think at the moment the provisions allow far too much, allow the line to be drawn far too much in favor of restriction and clamping down and limiting. And simply notifying people that you are limiting doesn't mean that it isn't a serious limitation and maybe even a violation of a right. So, yes, demarcation in itself is vital, but it doesn't solve the problem of whether the limitation that flows from such a demarcation is or is not justifiable. I've dealt with the penalties question. The question of whether the bill is a necessity in view of the fact that we already have legislation around terrorism and trespass and so on. I don't think that I want to commit myself to an answer, again, off the cuff on that one. But something tells me that we do need some legislation around that justifies reasonable limitations of access. Trespass, for example, is a matter of unlawful presence on the property that belongs to another person. You have no right to be there. And you, perhaps there's a legitimate feeling that you are up to no good being there and so on. So the private owner of a piece of property puts up a sign that says trespassers will be prosecuted. There's an understanding that you have no right to be there in the first place. It's private property. But I have a right to be in Parliament. The Constitution tells me that. And I have a right to be in any number of other potentially critical pieces of infrastructure. So simply relying on trespass provisions there I don't think is adequate. Similarly, terrorism. You might legitimately want to restrict people's access, not because you fear that any particular one of them is going to carry out an act of violence or terrorism in any way, but simply because you fear that they may see something which they oughtn't to see, and their risk is attached to that they may go and talk about it afterwards or sneak a photograph with their cell phone or whatever. So I do think that we need some legislation to control access to potentially important infrastructure. And I don't think that either the existing law around terrorism or trespass fits that bill sufficiently. I dealt with the council on the separation of powers. I'm encouraged to hear that some members agree that 60 days perhaps is more suitable than 30 days notice. The provisions around who pays for the costs of securing the infrastructure. Linked then to the question around a means test and so on. I think the point is a fairly simple one, that there's something inherently unfair about asking a private individual or a private corporation to carry the costs of a public purpose. I was talking during the break about the example of private syndicate dams, of which we have a few in our country, where groups of farmers over the years have got together to put up the costs of building relatively small dams, but they're important anyway. Now, they are critical for the well-being of certain rural areas. As I understand it, sometimes actual towns draw on that water, not simply the farmers themselves. Now, you could very well, I'd be surprised if some of those are not already national key points, but you could very well end up declaring those private dams to be critical infrastructure. And to ask the farmers who own and control them then to carry the costs of fencing and lighting and alarms and security guards, etc., could ruin them, really. These are not necessarily wealthy people. So why should a public purpose not be paid for out of the public purse? That's the question that needs to be asked. The heritage comparison, I appreciate that we do place limitations on people's private ownership of certain things, old buildings, etc., because of heritage considerations. But I think it's slightly different there, because what we're telling such people is you may not, simply because you're the private owner, knock this place down. or damage it or renovate it in some way that destroys its heritage character. We're not necessarily telling that person, you need to go and spend millions and millions on our behalf because we think that it should be painted a different color, or, you know, that it should have a thatched roof and not a slate roof or whatever the case is. I think, again, if the public demanded that in the name of the public good that such expenditure should be undertaken on a private property, the public would be required to pay for it. So the difference is between preventing a private owner from damaging something on the one hand and forcing a private owner on the other hand from, you might say, upgrading. And I didn't hear the part of the submission, but I heard in the questions that there was talk about in Kandla, and we can talk more closer to home to the property of the Mayor of Cape Town, which also came under scrutiny recently for security upgrades and all the rest of it. I think this is analogous to what we are discussing. We accept that presidents and mayors and cabinet ministers and various others, I'm not sure about chairpersons of portfolio committees, have, that the public has a legitimate interest in their security, and therefore the public pays for the camera and for the policeman that sits in the little box outside and so on. We have no argument with that. Our argument is when we think it's gone too far, obviously. So we don't say to the Mayor of Cape Town or to the President of the Republic, we think that your house is a piece of critical infrastructure, therefore you must pay for security cameras. No, we pay for them. The same principle should apply here. And then the last question, Chairperson, I think was whether the basic public service, whether we should instead talk about essential public services. Again, I'm hesitating to answer that because I think one would need to sort of follow it through the bill and see what the ramifications would be of changing that. But again, I can see basic, in a sense, does not mean non-essential. Basic for me talks about that without which you cannot really get on. It forms the basis. So something like a railway station and a railway line is both basic and essential, I think. But you can hear that I'm thinking off the top of my head. I don't think that one replaces the other. You might, and I think you can argue, that some public services are more vital, more important than others. I guess Cape Town Central Railway Station is of much greater importance, significance to the lives of the city than a small little rural station that has a train once a day. But they both form part of our basic transport infrastructure. One may be more deserving of protection than the other, but it doesn't mean that the other is not deserving at all. I hope I've answered some of the questions, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Advocate, for your input. Members, is there any follow-ups? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Of course, if there's anything additional information you want to make available to the committee, you're very much welcome. Thank you very much. Colleagues, we're going to move on to the African Policing Civilian Oversight Forum. They are welcome to join us here in front. They will be the next presenter. If you can, maybe introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Tumile Sali. I'm a project officer at the African Policing Civilian Oversight Forum. As APCOF, we welcome the replacement of the board national.
Okay.
As APCOF, we welcome the replacement of the National Key Points Act with the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill. However, we do have a primary concern. One, in relation to the definition of the critical infrastructure, which we of the view that it is inconsistent with the constitution and the broader legislation. I think my colleagues from the society have mentioned here that section 16 of the proposed bill, it is too broad. It might open a gap for other unnecessary institutions or buildings to be declared as a critical infrastructure. In particular, our secondary concerns, they relate to access to information, the lack of clarity or as to what constitutes an offense, and the lack of transparency or accountability relating to the process to determine the critical infrastructure or the key point. So we are of the view that in as much as we welcome the replacement of the national key point, that the new bill or the new act that we envisage it should be in line with the constitution. So we are of the view that certain provisions of the proposed bill are not in line with the constitution of the Republic of South Africa. So with this current form, this bill, it might, on section 16, it might include medical clinics, schools, universities, and other institutions. And restricting assets on stating monetary searches may limit their function, which is right to health, right to education, etc. I'll make one example. Yesterday, we had BASA presenting the Banking Association of South Africa. So they mentioned that with Section 16, they have an opportunity to apply for banks and ATMs to be declared as critical infrastructure. And yesterday as well, Viceroy released a report about Capitec. It means that should I lose my money at Capitec, I can't go and protest outside Capitec, because Capitec will be declared a critical infrastructure. And also, places required for the provision of basic services and which enable fulfillment of basic rights should be excluded. That is our view. So there are places like your sanitation department of the city of Cape Town in Belleville. If that building is declared as a critical infrastructure, so if a person who's in an informal settlement without a toilet, without access to water, forget about day zero. We already have day zero in informal settlements. It means that I cannot go outside the building of the city of Cape Town and protest and to for water in that building. Our secondary concern is in relation to the appointment criteria for the council. So we are of the view that much emphasis is placed on the security-related skills for the council. So we are of the view that it should be broadened and not only limited to security-related skills. It should include our approach. It should be more of protective than being reactive. It should include experts on natural disasters, climate change, architectures, service people who are involved in service delivery, community safety experts, the civil society, and the academia. So we are of the view that with the current form of the bill, that the council will be security focused than being a developmental focus. So when we look into the critical infrastructure properties, we should not only look into the security aspect, we should also look into the development aspect. Let's say, for example, that Quebec is under siege from other forces. Let's say there's a rise in the sea levels. That will not require the police or security experts to be charged. So we often do that. The Security Council, it should be more inclusive, should include researchers or academics, civil society, experts in various fields, and not only people who have expertise in security. Also the bill, I think in section 24, it allows for private organizations to be contracted to perform the duties that are clearly mandated through South African Police Services in section 205(3) of the Constitution. SARS is given a mandate to maintain public order, meaning that public order policy, it is the responsibility of South African Police Services. With the current bill, it gives powers to private securities to perform public order policy. Let's say, for example, there's a protest at CPUT. The rest of CPUT does not need to call the police. If the security personnel, they can do that. So I think that is a gap that has been opened by this bill. And also, in the same section, I think section 24, the bill presupposes accreditation procedures that are not as present rigorous or incomplete. And also the role of CIRA is unclear. For example, the bill states that in order to have these powers that I mentioned above, that are not in line with section 203 of the Constitution, that a security company in question, it should be accredited by the state security agents. And then the question is that should a company, can I just register a company, go straight to the security agency, or should this company be first registered by CIRA and then the security agency and so forth. So we are of the view that CIRA requires further development to be included. And also, section 26 of the bill, it criminalizes legitimate disclosures of information as well as illegitimate. And the effect is to limit access to information, which is protected by section 32 of the Constitution. It also undermines the work of academics, researchers, activists, journalists to report and record into about the criminal infrastructure, which is in the public interest. So we are of the view that section 26, it criminalizes legitimate disclosure of information. So, for example, if I'm an activist, I'm a committee activist, I'm a researcher, it therefore means that I cannot report about corruption or something that is happening in an institution which has been declared as a criminal infrastructure. And also the penalties for disclosure are significant and oppressive. And then odds with the constitutional emphasis on freedom. And I think the latter speaker spoke about the sentences that are being proposed in the bill. For example, in the National Key Point Act, it is said that if you have transgressed the act, you will be jailed or imprisoned for up to 3 years, a sentence up to 3 years. With the current proposed bill, it goes further to 20 years, it goes further to 30 years. So I don't know if whether sentences, they inflate as well, just like inflation, from 3 years and now to 30 years. So maybe we can get clarity from the members, or from the honorable members, to clarify us. So what is the rationale from moving from 3 years to 30 years? And also, it will also have a wider impact. It will also create a burden into the criminal justice system as well. So you are going to have people who spend 20 years, 30 years in prison for picketing outside a criminal infrastructure. Or you're going to have an academic who was doing the research on a criminal infrastructure who spends 15 to 20 years in prison. We know that our prisons are overcrowded as we speak. Now you're going to have more people who are raising issues about toilets going to jail. Going to have more academics, researchers who spend time in jail at the state's expense because they were reporting on these buildings. And lastly, our proposals as the APCO for that in Chapter 2 of the appeal, that the appointment criteria should be expanded and not only include security experts, and also the definition, it should be revised to expressly exclude places from which basic services are delivered. And Chapter 4 should be revised as well to expressly provide that public order policing remains a function of the South African Police Services and is not outsourced to private security companies. And Chapter 4 to be revised, Chapter 5 to be revised to ensure that the powers granted to private security companies under Section 25 are consistent with the rights to privacy as guaranteed in Section 14 of the Constitution. And also Section 26 should be amended to align with Section 32 of the Constitution, which is access to information protections. I'm going to pause there. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation and the input. Honourable members, we go to questions. Honourable Mark.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm not sure whether I heard the presenter correctly about the zero, what do they call it, the zero day that is coming. Or in the townships, it has always been a zero day. Only in the towns where it hasn't been zero day. I only have one thing on the Section 26 of the bill, criminalizes legitimate disclosures. I'm not very sure whether this is not covered in the purpose of the Act. 2B. It says, ensure that information pertaining to critical infrastructure remain confidential, subject to Promotion of Access to Information Act. I'm not sure whether that doesn't cover that, because it says subject to. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honourable Markey. Honourable Mbele.
Thank you, Chair. My question is along similar lines of thinking to what Honourable Markey asked, but on a different issue. The secondary concern highlighted around the composition of the council, with the suggestion that it should include expertise informed on, amongst other things, natural disasters. I just wanted to ask whether the inclusion of an official as per clause, what is it, 3 sub clause A, Roman numeral 7, an official from the National Disaster Management Center, would that not be seen as sufficient to cover base within the council on issues of natural disasters, especially given that, if I understand correctly, the procedure is that when there is some sort of disaster that's been declared or identified, the JOC that is activated to then respond to that and mitigate the risks would be coordinated by the relevant disaster center, whether national or provincial, and if that is assessed not to be to be sufficient, what would be a possible alternative suggestion to then plug the gap? Yeah, thanks, Chair.
Honourable Bailey. Honourable.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson. When it comes to exclusion, I had your points, which to me, most of them are very valid. But how would you assist us, particularly in the exclusion of institutions that provide basic services? You know, I want to draw your attention particularly to the question of, you know, national reservoirs of the country. during the era of war, in under any situation of war, these become first targets, because you know that once you destroy them, then you have actually then ruined any possibility of that particular nation to sustain itself. Now these things, these dams need to be protected, but they form part of basic services to the public, general public. How would you like to draw the line there? Because definitely these reservoirs, they play a key role, but then also the question of their national standing needs some kind of protection. I just want you to help us there. Then secondly, you spoke about Section 24, of which I would agree with you that particularly if you were to abrogate the responsibility of maintenance of public order to private security companies which are not necessarily trained for that, that will be very problematic. But you are raising the question of Syria. But to me, it comes to me, because this committee also deals with Syria related activities. Now, to me, no private security industry will exist or company will exist or function without being first registered with Syria. So in what way would you like Syria to be involved or participate in this particular process? Thanks.
Honorable Ramatakani.
Thank you. I've got one question. Your primary concern is a definition problem. You do say that the definition of the bill may be inconsistent with the Constitution. Now, you don't quite explain which of the definition, because there are a number of them, the list of them. So you have one sentence that covers, I mean, about list of about maybe 10 or so, 15 definitions. If you can be precise, which of the definition seems to be unconstitutional or maybe inconsistent with constitutionality, then we can deal with that. Maybe if you can help us with that. I tried to read them as you were presenting, and I don't know which one of the was the fairly standard. It looks very standard. If you could just explain that. Certainly we do not want to have a bill at the end of the day that is in conflict with the Constitution. It's one thing that we will make sure it doesn't happen, but help us to understand which of these definitions you think it's almost overreaching. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members, for your input. Over to you, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. I'll start with the composition of the concern. That our major concern is that the focus is on persons from the private sector with security skills, and it does not look into other expertise that we have in South Africa. I've mentioned many, like architectures, planners, civil society, academics, and so forth. So our major concern is with the intent of having a council that only has people with one set of skills and not being brought and look into other skills set that we have in the country. Hence we mentioned like what happens when there are natural disasters and so forth. Do we have such skills in the council, or you only have people who have expertise in security cluster or expertise and not have knowledge or tested knowledge in other departments as well? So we are calling for a council that is inclusive and also taking into consideration that we have civil society organizations, we have academics, we have architects, we have planners, and so forth. It will also assist when should the Department of Public Works decides to build a building that will be classified as a critical infrastructure. So you hear those skills in the council that, okay, that is how we should design and so forth. So that is our primary concern with the conversation.
Thank you. Sorry for the interruption. Honorable Mulabachi wants to follow up.
I'm also sorry. But have you also considered how big the council will be if everybody is catered for?
We, if I'm not mistaken, it will be about six members of the council. So we're not saying that all, everyone, even soccer experts, they should form part of the bill. At least the council itself, it should be inclusive in hotel. And you don't just draw from one bucket, you put in the council. It should be diverse with people with different expertise. So that is our major call that they have called. Yeah. On the issue that was raised by Honorable Mhlongo on basic services, we I hear you. And we agree with your sentiments that your dams, your water reservoirs and so forth, they are a critical infrastructure. But now, with the definition of Section 16, it opens up for, I mentioned an example about day zero, about the city of Cape Town declaring, for example, because I'm based in Cape Town, declaring that a city municipal building which deals with the provision of basic services, then they declare that building as a critical infrastructure because it provides basic services into communities. And also universities as well. Education is a critical, universities are a critical infrastructure as well. Let's say that students decide to protest at CPUT, and then the rector or the council decides to apply to the council and say that we want our institutions to be declared is a critical infrastructure, meaning that all these draconian or laws that are specified in Section 25 and Section 26 are going to come in place now, meaning that if there's a protest at CPUT, Section 25 comes in, Section 26 comes in, we have students protesting for free education or any other issue being arrested or sentenced to up to 30 years because they were what? Protesting for a basic issue, which is education. So that is our worry as APCOF, that with Section 26 being brought as it is, it gives a right to other institutions where to apply for their institutions to be declared as critical infrastructure. On CIRA, we understand that, the Section 24, I think, is silent on that. They're saying that the private security company that will look after, or that will say, the critical infrastructure, it should be accredited by the state security agents. So the question we're asking as a COF is, are we going to jump CIRA? Will the company go straight to the state security agency? Or will the company go to CIRA and then be accredited by the state security agents? So we recommend that there should be clarity in Section 24. It should be clear from the Act as well that this is the process that such a security company should follow, that you first go through CIRA and you go to state security agency as well. And the section that Section 16 might be inconsistent with the Constitution. I think that was the last question. It is inconsistent in the sense that, as I've made an example about the city of Cape Town in your building or your clinic, for example, they provide a basic service. And if you look into Section 16, any institution that provides basic services, it can be declared as a critical infrastructure. It means that Honorable Mhlongo, with his members of EFF, they can't go to a hospital in Mthatha and do an inspection in that hospital because that hospital, it is declared a critical infrastructure. So our major concern is that should these buildings or these institutions that provide basic services be declared as critical infrastructure, other rights are going to be infringed, like your right to access to information. It means that Honorable Mhlongo Khan and his EFF comrades can now go and do inspection in hospitals because these hospitals are declared as criminal infrastructure. So that, and also reporters as well, they cannot report about Honorable Mhlongo's visit because they visited a critical infrastructure. So academics cannot record that or do research in that because these institutions are being declared as a critical infrastructure. On the, so our major concern is on the definition that is too broad and wide. And also my response also answers the first question that was asked in terms of promotion of access to information, if whether the purpose of the bill doesn't cover that. By virtue of the definition of Section 16, once you open up even ATS, I made an example about Capitec as well, if people's money will go, it means that people, they cannot go and protest outside Capitec. It means that you infringe other rights as well in the long run. So that is our major, that's why Section 16 is our, we object Section 16 and is also our priority in this instance. Thank you.
Very much. Any other members?
Just quickly, I'm just following up on the same question I was asking. I hear the explanation, but as I can understand, I know there's no clinic here that has been declared essential services and prohibit the rights of access. So therefore, if it's an assumption that it may be, it does not make it a fact. So my point was simply, if there is a one definition, now you're talking about applicability of the law, maybe, which is something else compared to a definition. I thought maybe we will say the way the infrastructure is defined is unconstitutional, or the way the police officials are defined is unconstitutional, so that we can look at that and then change. But now you're talking about something else. I'm just not sure, therefore, that if you can give me a specific, I'm worried about this, the easy right of unconstitutionality, which is not tested as a fact, because we will at the end of the day have to come up with an act here which is constitutional. So that's why I'm asking, because you are the writer of this thing, I'm asking, or we can leave it there, but if there is no, you are worried about applicability of the law, how it's going to be applied and so on, that's another matter altogether. But here what I was concerned about is a definition, but I'm willing just to leave it there, but I haven't heard you saying specifically this definition is unconstitutional, this definition is unconstitutional. So it's a broad stroke type of writing, which is could be taking us in the wrong direction, but I leave it there. We will engage as a committee with that part, once we engage with the bill itself.
Okay. No, let us not leave it there. I'm going to clarify you. We are not saying Section 16 is unconstitutional, but the definition is too broad and is too wide. Unfortunately, I don't have the act in front of me, but I am going to make a follow-up and send that specific section, which speaks about a building or provision of basic services. Is there in Section 16? But I'm not sure which clause, whether it's subsection 1 or 2 and so forth, but it is there in the Act. So the reason why I'm making an example about sanitation, water, and clinics, because those are basic services, it creates a gap for Cape Town Clinic or the Ministry of Health to apply for clinics to be declared as critical infrastructures because they provide a basic service to the people. So what I'm saying is that leaving these sections being too broad as it is, it might infringe on other rights as well. When you read it with Section 25 and Section 26 of the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill. So that is my argument.
Thank you very much. Members, anything to add? So maybe we can just maybe ask the Secretariat just maybe also to inquire with SAPS on CIRA whether they want to comment further on the Section 24 matter. You know, then we can get feedback on Tuesday because we will have to address it later as well. But thank you very much. Valuable input. Thank you to AFCOP. Right, members, we come to COSATU, Mr. Matthew Parks, the Parliamentary Coordinator. I just want to get an indication, the South Durban Community Alliance, are they here? Doesn't seem to be here. Any other residents of Durban present? Maybe they... Welcome to Mr. Matthew Parks. You're very much welcome, sir. Members, we're going to go now to COSATU and the Parliamentary Office Representative, Mr. Matthew Parks.
Good afternoon, colleagues, honourable members, friends and comrades. Yeah, my name is Matthew Parks. I'm from the Congress of South African Trade Unions. I think we'd want to welcome and thank the Chair and the Committee for making space for us to share our views on the bill. It's quite a critical bill for COSATU. I think listening to the comments from various civil society organizations and from members across party lines, I think it's very healthy debates here, Chair, which we value and so on. I think, look, for us, Chair, we welcome the Critical Infrastructure Protection Bill. We've long had problems with the National Key Points Act. It's made life very difficult for many of our affiliate unions and our members. So we're very happy to see this NKPA be chucked out the window and be replaced by a new law which will be in line with the democratic constitution and the values and so forth. Chair, look, our position on this is not just a theoretical position, it's based upon the experience of our members. So we have members who are nurses and doctors, public hospitals. We have Nahao members who work in various public institutions. We have SAPAO members at SASL. We have NU members who work at ESCOM. So really, it's quite a broad scope of membership which impacts upon us. We have SATAR members who want to picket or organize at the airport and managers abuse their rights to organize, etc. But I'll get into that in a little bit, Chair. I think I must also say as COSATU we were fortunate to be part of NEDLAC, where we had very detailed, in-depth engagements with government. And I think we must really appreciate the Secretariat for the Police for engaging us in an open and constructive manner. Many of our issues were very nicely dealt with there, and it's always kind of good to have government departments which should come with an open mind and want to engage and find a win-win compromise for all parties. Sometimes, Chair, we have departments who come to NEDLAC and they basically want to give us tell us to go and jump in the nearest lake. I think the Secretary here was really progressive with us. But, Chair, yeah, having said that, I think the parliamentary process, Chair, I think just listening to the very constructive discussions this morning, I think this bill could even be further enriched and strengthened in line with the Constitution. We do support its progressive proposals, revisions, as well as have a few amendments which we think might help to strengthen further the bill. I must also apologize, Chair. You know, sometimes one has gremlins, and when I looked at my submission yesterday, I realized I had one or two silly mistakes I had left there. I hope members didn't see on it, so I quickly deleted it yesterday. I reprinted another copy today, and I also had one or two other things. So I know Honorable Ramachandran is very sharp on picking up those small gremlins. Chair, look, I think our founding provision basically was the National Key Points Act. It's been indicated it was drawn up during the height of the apartheid era, they reflected the legal ethos of the party regime. And we really need to get such a bill, a critical law, in line with the democratic constitution. Our main frustrations around the Key Points Act is that many times our unions were blocked from organizing, from joining a union, from the unions having access to the points of work, and even other issues of the right to disclose corruption, the right to health and safety, etc. There has been an endless source of frustration. And of course, I think as previous speakers mentioned, that there was excessive secrecy provisions, and I think maybe fundamentally there was a lack of checks and balances on the power of the executive. So currently under the NKPA, the minister has sole discretion. He can declare your place a key point. And this bill really goes a long way in shifting away from that regime. Chair, look, I think as COSATU, our first duty is to service our members' needs. And our first port of engagement with the department or the secretariat was that this bill must not interfere anyway with workers' rights to unionize, to organize, to picket, to protest, disclose corruption, etc. And we're very glad it doesn't touch upon those areas. There are limitations to workers' rights like any other rights. But Chair, your rights to unionize is provided for the LRA, and this bill does not touch upon the LRA. That is for to a sacrosanct. The right to protest, to picket, is within the Regulation of Gatherings Act, which is important to us. And of course, the disclosure of corruption, etc., dealt with other bills. So we're very happy this bill solely deals with critical infrastructure, not touching upon other issues. If it had touched upon a chair, we would have been very violently opposed to it. So we're clear that we're happy that issue was dealt with nicely. Chair, also on that same basis of labor relations, on the essential services issue. So essential services is covered by the LRA. If a government department wants to declare whatever public servant essential services, they must go to the Essential Services Commission, motivate, and they'll decide yes or no. But then they also come to an agreement on a minimum service level agreement. So that takes into account health and safety issues, etc. Again, Chair, we're glad this doesn't touch upon that. We don't love the essential services, but that's under the jurisdiction of the LRA and the Essential Service Commission. So again, we're happy this has not entered or interfered with that issue, Chair. Because there is a creeping problem with many departments wanting to declare everything essential services. You know, Department of Education, every now and then, when they're not happy with teachers, they want to declare teachers essential services, mixing kind of popular issues with what really is an essential service, which is actually a doctor or a nurse or a police officer at the border post, and not other services. So we're glad about that issue. So other issues which are very important to us, that it must affect the constitution, which this bill does. Again, as you said, it must not interfere with the LRA, the Disclosures Act, PAYA, PAJA, Regulation Gatherings Act. We're glad about that. Chair, I think we're also comforted that a key part of the bill is the definition of threats. And it's quite clear it deals with criminals, criminal activity, terrorist activities, issues of accidental nature or natural hazards. And we're confident that most of our members, if not all, wouldn't fall into those categories, Chair. If they do, then good luck to them. But we're quite glad that this thing deals with stuff like terrorism, Chair, which unfortunately is a reality of life. You would know that in Cape Town, Chair, about 20 years ago, we had a serious problem with terrorism across the board. Chair, I think we're also quite pleased that the previous vague definitions were tightened up. And again, that helped us to avoid an unintended consequence of abusing labor rights down the road. Chair, we're also quite supportive of the unlawful intent aspects. So it's one thing to transgress the law, but it must have a very clear unlawful intent, unlawful purpose, unlawful action. So that puts the onus upon the prosecutor, the police, or whoever's laying the charge, to prove that you had an unlawful intent. You wouldn't just take a picture of Tainais as a tourist, or Honorable Ramaswamy was posing in front of the Madiba statue. The prosecution must prove the unlawful intent. But, and again, same with trespassing, Chair. And I think even with the trespassing issue, Chair, we're glad that the onus is upon the manager of the CI to display very clearly this is a critical infrastructure. Because at times, you know, yes, there's 200 points currently, and people might not be aware of that. So again, that helps the person if he's accused of trespassing. The manager of that site must prove that he has very clearly declared this is a key point. But Chair, I think having said that, listening to colleagues' presentation, maybe perhaps what the committee could look at tightening up the wording, maybe saying, for example, if you're taking a photo, it must be of sensitive security measures, as opposed to just taking a photo of Honorable Bukeman in front of Parliament, you know, something like that, or in sensitive security areas. Because, yeah, I don't think that turnstile at the visitor center of Parliament is a very secure or sensitive area. But maybe underground bunkers to protect members might be more secure. You know? Chair, I think then on the issue of searches, we were glad that the right access to a CI is provided for. We were glad that in terms of the searching of persons entering their place, there must be respect to decency and to order, and it must be done by a person of the same gender as you. But, you know, as workers, often this right is abused. You have women especially being strip searched in a very inhumane, invasive way. So we think, Chair, really it could be that we need to strengthen the wording to specifically prohibit stripping persons naked, searching the orifices, and so on. Because it's not just a question of mine workers having been humiliated like that, but you'll find many, many workplaces, women and other workers are being abused. It might seem far-fetched, something from the dark days of apartheid, Chair, but you'll find a shop right, which is not a key point, but you'll find workers being humiliated and searched by security and strip searched and so on. So I think it might be good to specifically be a bit tighter here. Chair, one of the reasons also why we're supportive of this bill is the critical infrastructure panel. So again, it's a departure from the minister having sole power to decide, to declare Nkandla as a key point, for example. So you have a panel just set up. It must process the applications and make the recommendations. You have a civilian chairing it, the police secretary. You invite members of the public to make nominations for the panel. You specifically include private sector persons and specifically require specific skills like an engineer. So it's not just a question of politicians sitting there and abusing positions. I think, Chair, that will help us to avoid a very narrow security focus. So we really welcome that thing as a key change. I think, Chair, also the designation process by the CI panel is important. I think we also welcome specifically the role of the police commissioner. So it's not just a question of a local police officer or an ESCOM manager declaring a key point. The police commissioner must have an oversight role around that application. And, of course, the specific comment, the provision that there must be public comments. The police commission must invite comments from the public, which is a significant change. But having said that, Chair, I think there's a bit of a sequential gap around the public comments provision. So when you apply, or when a commissioner takes into account the application for the declaration of the CI, he must ask for public comments. And when he forwards the documentation to the CI panel, he must include those public comments. But there's not a specific clause requiring when the CI panel makes its decision or recommendation that it must take into account the public comments. Or when the minister makes the final decision that he takes into account public comments. So we think sequentially we should just tighten that up to make sure that they have to take into account public comments. They may disagree with them, they may reject them, it's fine, it's their right. But I think specifically, Chair, they should be required to do it, not just kind of ignore it and let things fall through the cracks. We had a kind of a broad agreement on that issue at NEDLAC, Chair, but I think it might have fallen through the cracks as it came to Parliament. Do you think we can fix it up, Chair? I think coming towards the end, Chair, and I know I'm in a bit of a disadvantage because I'm between you and lunch. Oh, they're against lunch. Okay, let me speak for 3 hours then. No, Chair, yeah, I think coming towards the end, with regards to the parliamentary oversight, we're quite happy with the proposals. I think we're happy with the issue of having a register for the key points, to avoid those battles of the past where people wanted to access what is the list of key points, etc. I think we're pleased that the panel, etc., must report to Parliament annually on the key points. And of course, we hope Parliament would exercise this jurisdiction oversight as strongly as possible. I think, Chair, also we're specifically pleased that the reports to Parliament must go to Parliament itself and not just to the Intelligence Committee. Our fear about the Intelligence Committee is that by its rules, it's secret. Even other members don't have the right to go to the Intelligence Committee. And whatever's submitted there is behind closed doors. So I think we prefer to let it come to Parliament. We think that it should go to the Police Committee as a relevant oversight body. But having said that, Chair, there's nothing that if there's a security risk at Coburg, there's nothing stopping the panel, the police, SSA, from going straight to the Intelligence Committee to say there's a specific risk at Coburg, we must report it, because that's within their jurisdiction. But I think the annual reports must come to Parliament, and that helps to ensure some public oversight around it, Chair. So, yeah, Chair, in conclusion, I think we welcome the progressive provisions, especially on labour rights, that it doesn't interfere with the many progressive legislation that have come into effect since 1994. I think we're pleased the threat is quite specific around criminal or terrorist activity, etc. I think we're also pleased with the unlawful intent clause as well, because it helps to protect innocent persons accused. Well, we're very pleased on the public participation clause and the establishment of the CI panel, as well as the parliamentary oversight aspect. And I think basically our proposals is one around the issue of strip searches, and of course I think around expanding the public comment sequentially, that it's throughout all the processes, not just the application but the decision-making processes. As I mentioned, Chair, earlier, I think just listening to other colleagues' presentation this morning, maybe about tightening up the photography issue about security measures, sensitive security measures, or sensitive security areas. Chair, I'm sorry if my thing is very short and sweet, but really most of our issues were addressed through the NEDLAC engagements, and I think it helped with the police secretary's attitude to be progressive and inclusive. So I think, Chair, we were largely relieved, because for many years we've been waiting with great anticipation for this bill, given our members' huge problems with the National Key Points Act, and we're largely happy that most issues have been addressed. But I must say, maybe in confusion, Chair, look, we're not blind to what civil society is raising about the need for transparency. It's very important, and we must get the balance right. But also, we're equally not blind to the need for legitimate security measures in place. And unfortunately, we do live in a world where there are crazy people who blow up things, and often it's our members who are victims of that. So when Planet Hollywood was blown up at the waterfront in 98, those waitresses are SACAL members, and so on and so forth. So I hope our position submission has been helpful and useful. Yeah, thanks very much, Chair, for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Parks, for your input. We appreciate that. Members, we go to questions. The first from my side, I just want to know, some of the civil society organizations, and I think also Greenpeace yesterday, raised the issue of constitutionality very sharply. I just want to get an indication, what is your view on the issue of constitutionality, because it's an important question that was raised, limitation of rights. According to your presentation, you're satisfied that it's covered by other legislation, but just to get your take on that. Let's go to the other members. Honourable Marke, Honourable Mhlongo.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just one question. I think I'm asking you for the second time, but I see here, because COSATU is in NEDLAC, it was discussed there, just to get clarity. 3.3 on the presentation, on the long presentation, essential and basic services. If I could get some explanation on, the advocate tried to explain, but he was just saying it on his own understanding. The difference between the two, which one, why did you prefer basic services to essential, and so on and so on. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Marke. Honorable Mhlongo.
No, thanks, Chair. I would like to know, with regard to the processes at NEDLAC, have you agreed to a process of actually then as to how this committee is going to be appraised of concrete final agreements that we have arrived at, and which minister will be responsible? Is it the Labour Minister or whatever that will actually then interact with the committee moving forward on this particular legislation? Number two, did I hear you well to say that your only area of caution is to say the development of the bill must not encroach on either individual or collective rights, particularly of your members, as you put it. Otherwise, if that is taken care of, then you agree with the whole contents of the bill. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Molobatsi.
Thank you, Chair. What is your view on the composition of the council? I might have missed it, I'm not sure. But again, tell us about the maximum penalties. I might have missed it also. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Any other members? Thank you, members. Mr. Parks, you're welcome to respond.
Okay, yeah, so thanks, Honourable Members. I think, Chair, in terms of the question you raised about constitutionality, I mean, I haven't heard those submissions. I really don't see anything in the bill unconstitutional. But having said that, Chair, I mean, there's nothing wrong with the committee, for example, saying to the Constitutional Court, can you certify if you are confident of this? Or any member of Parliament or the public, etc. Well, I think we are confident that it would pass constitutional muster. See, Chair, I mean, I'm trying to think off my head. It doesn't interfere with the right to strike. It doesn't touch upon strikes. It doesn't touch upon protests. Doesn't touch upon rights to unionize, etc. It just deliberately left all those areas completely silent and left those relevant legislation to speak. So, Chair, and I think even other issues that would work in its favor is the public participation clauses, the parliamentary oversight clauses, etc. So I would be quite surprised if it didn't pass constitutional muster. But having said that, Chair, I'm not saying that the comments from other colleagues are not useful. They might be very well useful to help enrich the bill. It might help find each other. Many of the questions that colleagues had raised earlier are questions we had raised in our NEDLAC engagements, and we were satisfied that we found each other with the Secretariat, etc., on these issues. I think, Chair, in terms of honourable market, in terms of essential services, it was an area we were very worried about in the beginning, because there is a creeping tendency by government departments to expand the scope of essential services. We were worried about the wording at first, but I think we managed to find each other. We're pleased that it's not touching upon the LRA's essential services. It doesn't touch upon the declaration of essential services. Doesn't touch upon the limitation of labor rights that are currently provided for under the LRA and the Essential Services Commission. It doesn't deal with the issue of minimum service level agreements that are there. So that we're happy for, Chair. So even if you declare tomorrow your house a key point, it doesn't mean that the staff working there are essential services. They're not. Whoever wants to declare those staff essential services must go to the Essential Services Commission, and good luck to them to motivate it. And then again, there's clear criteria about the issue of loss of life and death. But even Chair, on the Essential Services, there's not a blank check. So at hospitals, there's a minimum service level agreement. Some staff can go on strike. As long as there's sufficient staff which has been agreed upon beforehand with the unions are there to prevent loss of life, you know? Same with the police. I mean, you know that admin staff can go on strike. The secretary can go on strike. But there'll be a minimum level of security and personnel on duty, which is agreed beforehand, Chair. So we were comfortable with that, Honourable Marke. And we were comfortable that it didn't touch upon labour rights and so on. Honourable Mklongo? Yeah, in terms of the NEDLAC report, the Portfolio Committee should automatically have been given a copy of the NEDLAC report. I would assume that it was done. And that will reflect the kind of discussion at NEDLAC. And the NEDLAC chair is not just COSATU, so you have government, including the different government departments, not just the police. You have business, as in Business Unity SA. You have labor, as in COSATU, and so on. And I think, if memory serves me right, Chair, community was also part of that task team. Community includes SANCO, the youth, women, disability, etc. And I think, Chair, also on that point, most areas were able to find each other in the NEDLAC process. There were some areas, I think, especially with business, that were not able to find each other with government. But broadly, the majority of areas, we were able to find each other. So most of those issues actually fed into the bill that's before the committee itself, and changes were made that time as well. And again, Chair, yeah, to the Honourable Mklongo, we were comfortable that it didn't touch upon the labour rights. Specifically, that was our first point of discussion. And then I think lastly to Honourable Molabatsi, I think we are happy with the CIA panel that, first, you have a civilian chairing it, the Secretary for Police, not a police officer. I think the fact that it specifically provides for non-government persons to attend, the term is private sector. It's not just private sector as in business, it's anybody who's not from the government. And I think specifically, Chair, that it says you want certain skills, like engineering skills. So you're not just sending a bunch of politicians there who want to misbehave, but you're dealing specifically with critical infrastructure needs, Chair, and it's quite detailed. I think, Chair, also the provision for members of the public to make nominations to it. I heard earlier presenters talking about a role for Parliament on that panel. I think, Chair, that would enrich it as well. And there's ample precedence in terms of SABC and other boards around that. I think, Chair, look, in terms of the penalties, I mean, while I was listening to the discussion, maybe that's a space for the committee to look at it. The penalties might not be too harsh. We don't normally, it's a bit of a sliding scale. A majority of incidences wouldn't hit the 30 years penalty. But perhaps, Chair, there's a space to tighten the wording a little bit to address members of the public's concerns around it, Chair. Yeah, I hope I've answered everybody's questions, Chair.
Thank you very much. Members, any other questions on this issue? But Mr. Park, you've got anything else to add to the presentation?
Chair, no, I think just to thank the committee, and I think also to thank the police secretariat for engaging with us. We were quite worried when the bill first came out, and I think we've managed to address most of our issues. It's not often that we're not throwing stones at government departments, but when they do good work, I think we must give them credit, Chair. And I think, you know, even Honourable Caleb Barnard had raised a good point earlier about will we be better off for this bill. And I think I can say, Chair, without becoming a mbongi for government, I think the fact that you have a CI panel, you have public participation clauses, you don't have the minister having blank check, unfettered powers, blank check, whatever. Those are useful provisions, Chair. Those alone are significant progresses. The role of the parliamentary oversight is important things, Chair. But of course, I think there are spaces to further enrich and strengthen it within a reasonable measure, etc., Chair. So yeah, Chair, I'm a bit out of sorts not throwing stones at government today, but I think it reflects the positive engagement we had in NEDLAC and that we're able to address 99% of our issues, Chair. But yeah, of course, I think we'll just plead with the committee to look at the few proposals we had made around public participation being sequential throughout the processes, the issue of abuses of strip searching and maybe the tightening around the photography, trespassing, etc., Chair. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Honourable Members. Members, is there any additional submissions? Is there any other civil society organisation present that wants to do any presentation? Right, I think we received the pack. There's two or three organisations that couldn't make the presentations, but members can go through it in preparation. Then in terms of taking the process forward, we will, on this specific issue, meet again Tuesday at 10 o'clock to get feedback then from the Secretariat on all the issues that was raised by the presenters as well as those who couldn't make it, that we can get clause by clause indication what are the views and that members then can interact with the Department and the Civilian Secretariat and that we can have initial discussion. We will also utilize that afternoon for discussion because we're not going to go ahead on Wednesday due to our decision earlier today not to have a meeting on Wednesday. Then, Honourable Members, just to remind you, we will be in the same venue tomorrow morning at 9. The South African Police Service then will present to us. So thank you very much for being... it's B454, it's next door, tomorrow. Yeah. So thank you very much, Members. We will then close the meeting. Thank you. It's of course lunch.